It is Friday, November 1st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Tens of thousands of people in the country of Georgia have been protesting election results there this week, accusing the ruling party of fraud.
Do they want to build a European state and to join the European Union, or they want to go back to the post-Soviet swamp where this country belonged 30 years ago?
Also, Massachusetts is going after what's called zombie second mortgages. These are old loans thought to be dead that rise from the grave.
It puts people's homes at risk. So it is scary.
And Hezbollah has a new leader. We'll report after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Vice President Harris says former President Trump's use of violent rhetoric about a political opponent Thursday night should be disqualifying. As NPR's Tamara Keith explains, Harris is campaigning in Wisconsin.
In an onstage interview with Tucker Carlson, Trump said former Congresswoman Liz Cheney might be less of a war hawk if she had the experience of, quote, standing there with nine barrels shooting at her, and, quote, let's see how she feels about it, you know, when the guns are trained on her face. Harris said his rhetoric was violent and only getting more extreme.
This must be disqualifying. Anyone who wants to be president of the United States who uses that kind of violent rhetoric is clearly disqualified and unqualified to be president.
The Trump campaign dismissed the concern, saying his quote was taken out of context. Tamara Keith, NPR News, traveling with the vice president.
The Justice Department says it plans to send monitors to 27 states for Election Day. The department says the officials will look at compliance with federal voting rights laws. More from NPR's Ryan Lucas.
The Justice Department enforces federal laws that protect the right to vote. As part of that mission, it regularly sends staff to monitor polling places. This year, the department says it is sending monitors to 86 jurisdictions in 27 states. On Election Day itself, Justice Department personnel will be available to field questions and complaints about possible violations of federal voting rights laws. That includes statutes that prohibit voter intimidation and voter suppression, as well as laws that ensure access to the polls for people with disabilities. It says complaints about violence, threats of violence, or intimidation at polling places should first be reported immediately to local authorities. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. employers added fewer than expected jobs last month, but as NPR Scott Horsley reports, today's tally from the Labor Department was likely distorted by an ongoing strike at Boeing and by hurricanes that hit the Southeast.
The monthly jobs report shows U.S. employers added just 12,000 jobs in October, which is far below the pace of previous months, but the news comes with some important qualifiers. A drop in factory jobs, for example, was almost entirely accounted for by the Boeing strike, and Hurricanes Helene and Milton likely put a dent in job growth as well. The storms made landfall shortly before the jobs tally was conducted. The unemployment rate, which is less subject to those temporary distortions, showed no change in October. It remains a low 4.1%. Analysts do think the job market is gradually cooling. Wages are not going up as fast as they had been, although wage gains are still outpacing inflation, giving workers a real boost in their buying power. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks wound out the session in positive territory today despite the weaker-than-expected jobs numbers. The Dow rose 288 points to 42,052. The Nasdaq was up 144 points. You're listening to NPR. A regional public health department in Idaho is the first to no longer provide COVID-19 vaccines to residents in six counties there. It follows a narrow decision by the department's board. It would make Southwest District Health apparently the first in the nation to be restricted from giving COVID-19 vaccines. The area near the Idaho-Oregon border includes three counties in the Boise metro area. Vaccinations are generally deemed an essential function of public health departments. China's National Health Center is trying to encourage women there to have more babies by claiming it can make them smarter and healthier. NPR's Emily Fang reports that it's part of a sometimes heavy-handed tactic to try to encourage couples to have more children.
This week, China's National Health Center wrote on its social media account that giving birth could help relieve menstrual cramps, that it could help prevent ovarian cancer, and, quote, make a woman's brain more energetic. It wrote that these claims are backed by science, but did not provide specific studies or other evidence. The article was later deleted after public ridicule of its claims online. But it does illustrate how local and national authorities in China have been trying all sorts of ways to boost the country's flagging birth rate, including calling young married couples and asking if they'd consider having children. Earlier this week, China's cabinet launched a childbirth subsidy system that gives further tax cuts and medical housing and leave benefits for families. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices edged up slightly today. Oil rose 23 cents a barrel to settle at $69.49 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Z's Divine Espresso, offering organic coffees via drive-thru windows and inside at 1800 East 23rd Street and 2351 West 31st in Lawrence. CoffeeInLawrence.com.
65 degrees in Lawrence, 66 in Topeka, 69 in Manhattan. It is 4:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. One of the bedrocks of American democracy is the role of the U.S. military, which is why it may have stunned the nation to see that some 15% of those federally charged for the January 6th assault on the Capitol had military ties. But for many who served, this is also a time to encourage civic participation and push back on conspiracy theories around elections. We wanted to talk about those efforts. And here to help us are NPR's Odette Youssef and Quill Lawrence. Hello to both of you.
Hey, Elsa.
Hi.
Okay, Quill, I want to start with you because you sat down with a group of vets this week at a Pints and Patriotism event. Am I right? What is that? And tell us more.
Well, I was at a brewery called Tranquility Brewing in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and I was willing to make that sacrifice to go to a brewery where dozens of veterans were getting together to drink beer and chat. And it was convened by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA. And Allison Jaslow is a combat vet. She runs IAVA, and she opened up the discussion.
You know, whether you served in wartime or not, I think people who served in the U.S. military have had to prove over and over again that they put country before themselves. That doesn't mean that they always agree, but they know how to do it. You know, I think can allow veterans to lead by example at a time when America needs us most.
And they pass the mic around. They've done these events in Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And they're civil and they're friendly, though it's very clear there are people in the crowd who are voting for different presidential candidates. Mm. The other group sponsoring the chats is called Democracy First, and it's committed to supporting the electoral process, respectful discourse, and a peaceful transfer of power.
Well, Odette, we saw on January 6th some of the people trying to interrupt the peaceful transfer of power were themselves veterans, right? What are you hearing this election cycle from other veterans trying to counter that activity this time around?
Yeah, I spoke with Christopher Goldsmith, who's a veteran, and who started a group that exposes the activities of extremist groups. They do this by infiltrating them online. It's called the Task Force Butler Institute. And this time, Elsa, they've been scaling up their capacity, training more vets to do that research in the run-up to the election.
We want to be ready for the next January 6th type of event. So what we're doing is helping people understand what threats are on the horizon from extremists and also what threats are on the horizon from politicians who are embracing extremist violence.
And you'll remember, Elsa, that leading up to January 6th, a lot of people that were doing that kind of open source intelligence gathering knew that militia type groups were planning violence because they were planning it openly on social media. And so that's what these vets are looking out for. And Goldsmith is also working with other groups that are planning offline mobilizations of veterans during this cycle.
Wait, offline mobilizations? What does that mean?
Well, so one of the groups doing this is called Common Defense. It's a national progressive grassroots network of veterans. They have been assembling teams to deploy to locations where crises might unfold. You know, these would be unarmed vets training in de-escalation techniques. And for instance, you know, if they're hearing that, say, an angry armed mob of people are gathering at a vote tallying location, they might send a team there. Perry O'Brien is a veteran and co-founder of Common Defense.
We want to mobilize vets to be visible, to be out, and to help restore a sense of safety to folks, because a thing that we've heard very consistently is, like, having vets who are, you know, visibly veterans, you know, wearing hats like this and showing up helps people feel more secure.
Hmm. Okay, so you've got veterans who have participated in extremist groups, and you've got vets forming teams to counter those extremists. So, Quill, I mean, were you seeing this kind of polarization just in the conversations at that Pints and Patriotism event in Pennsylvania?
In some ways, it was just sort of a typical conversation. My vets are like anyone else, really. They've got a gamut of opinions, and the way they vote more often lines up with their age, race, and their gender than necessarily their veteran status. Mm. But there were a bunch of references to service and to veterans issues, and folks just seem to be glad to be there. We can listen to Patricia Crossley speaking. She's the wife of a veteran and has family who served in recent wars, and she and her husband disagree about how to vote.
We have different political views. We are voting for different people this election. And I said, when we got here, I'm picking a spot next to the door so that I can meet. I just want to say thank you, because I had no idea what I was expecting.
I mean, she and many others were just very grateful to have this safe space for a civil conversation. And that's what it was. And it was great. But it was kind of striking to me that we're at a point where it is so remarkable and rare that you can find a safe space for a civil conversation.
So true. That is NPR's Quill Lawrence and Odette Youssef. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
As voters here in the U.S. reckon with efforts by Russia to influence our election, spare a thought for Georgia. The country, not the state. It held parliamentary elections this past weekend, elections that the opposition is calling fraudulent. Tens of thousands of Georgians were out in the streets earlier this week protesting the results, and all eyes are on Georgia's powerful neighbor, Russia, which has a robust track record of interfering in, indeed of invading, Georgia. Well, joining us to talk about it is NPR's Moscow correspondent, Charles Maines, who is in Georgia, in the capital, Tbilisi. Hey, Charles.
Hi there.
What are the stakes of this election in Georgia?
You know, something to keep in mind is that the vast majority of Georgians, some 80%, favored joining the European Union. So all parties competing in these elections were formally for Euro integration. Yet it's the government of the ruling Georgia Dream Party that's implemented a series of, you know, seemingly pro-Russian policies, in particular a controversial foreign agents law that undermined that goal. And the policies not only put the country's once promising EU accession talks on hold, they raised the stakes of the vote, says Kornely Kakacha of the Georgian Institute of Politics.
Basically, Georgians have to decide where they want to see their country. Do they want to build a European state and to join eventually European Union, or they want to go back to the post-Soviet swamp where this country belonged 30 years ago?
Huh. Okay, so in that view, it's either join Europe or join the post-Soviet swamp. Despite all of that, the ruling party, Georgia Dream, they say they came out ahead.
Yeah, official results showed Georgia Dream with 54% of all votes. Four pro-Western opposition blocs got about 38% collectively. And the result allows Georgia Dream to maintain its hold on power and continue pursuing these policies that it argues promote peace. In fact, that was a central part of this election. If the opposition framed this as a choice between Russia and the West, Georgia Dream said it was between war and peace. So much so that election posters featured pictures of decimated Ukrainian cities side by side with prosperous, peaceful Georgian cities. So it's not such a subtle reminder that Georgia, too, was invaded by Russia in 2008. In fact, Russia currently occupies 20% of Georgia's territory.
Yeah, still all these years later. Okay, now the opposition and the country's president, who's not a member of the ruling party, they are denouncing this election, as we said, saying it's fraudulent. What is their evidence?
I put that question to Irma Povilashvili, who is part of a coalition of Georgian election monitors called My Vote. So she took me through a litany of electoral violations, including vote buying, ballot stuffing, multiple voting, in some cases physical intimidation, all of which led her to this conclusion, which we'll hear through an interpreter.
And when we are looking at the results that were published on the election day, we can say that they do not reflect the will of the Georgian people.
Do not reflect the will of the people, a serious charge. Okay, so how does the ruling party, which again is the official winner, at least according to the Electoral Commission, how do they respond to that, Charles?
You know, Georgia Dream says it won fair and square based on policy and economic successes. They also don't deny some problems with the vote. They just argue it didn't impact the ultimate result.
Mm. Charles, if I can try to sum up the situation, you're telling me we have a contested election, questions about Russian interference, protesters who've been in the streets. For Americans listening, with our own election day now 4 days away, is it fair to wonder if you and Georgia are living right now through what may be in our near future?
I guess we'll find out. I mean, the key here in Georgia may be the reaction from the West. The U.S. and the EU have both called for investigations into voting irregularities, but they stopped short of calling the election illegitimate, at least so far. Meanwhile, opposition parties here have called for another mass rally outside the parliament Monday.
NPR's Charles Maines in Tbilisi, Georgia, for us tonight. Thank you, Charles.
Good to talk with you.
Look, if you refer to San Francisco as San Fran, you might get dirty looks from people from there, including from myself, because it is lame. It is not a nickname that any resident uses. So when that term ended up emblazoned on a handful of residents' driver's licenses recently, well, it caused a bit of commotion.
When I have told San Franciscans about this, they cringe. And one of the people who received a license of San Fran on it, when she told her mother about the situation, her mother immediately advised her to burn the license.
That is California State Senator Scott Wiener, who represents San Francisco. This week, he wrote a letter to the head of the state's Department of Motor Vehicles, which reads, in part, I am requesting that DMV immediately cease and desist any and all uses of San Fran to refer to Tony Bennett's City by the Bay.
Wiener pointed out in his letter that, quote, no self-respecting San Franciscan would ever use the term San Fran.
As in truly never, he continued. Wiener told us there are plenty of other nicknames to choose from.
SF, the city, City by the Bay. Few people are allowed to use Frisco, but not very many people are allowed to use that. And then, of course, best city in the world, because it is the best city in the world.
I would never even use Frisco. We did catch up with the DMV, by the way. They told us, quote, the DMV agrees a no-nonsense San Francisco works best on a driver's license. They say it was a limited issue, which they have now fixed. And they promise that anyone whose license declares they live in San Fran can visit the DMV for a free replacement.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.7 FM in Emporia, and many other frequencies all around the state. You can listen online anytime at kansaspublicradio.org.
If it's not worth the time or effort to sell that old car, truck, or motorcycle, KPR's vehicle donation program will gladly take it off your hands so we can turn it into the programs you enjoy every day. Donate your vehicle online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Stay tuned. Coming up in our next half hour, news headlines. We will hear from Daniel Kurtzleben talking about the gender gap in this election. It is quite large, at least based on advance voting and polling. Women voting one way, men voting another. We'll learn more about the new leader of Hezbollah. And we will talk about something called zombie mortgages. The Massachusetts Attorney General is cracking down on a company collecting on what are called zombie second mortgages. What are zombie mortgages? We will tell you coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Woodhaven, Inc., manufacturing custom deck and siding solutions using sustainable woods and powered exclusively by wind energy. Located in Perry with shipping available to the entire KPR listening area. Details at woodhavenproducts.com.
Mark your calendars now, Saturday night, December 14th, for KPR's annual Big Band Christmas. It's at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. Super popular event, usually sells out. We have no reason to believe it won't this year as well. Get your tickets while they last at Liberty Hall and Ticketmaster.com. All the details about the program at kansaspublicradio.org. It is 4:20.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations order food online from a nationwide network of restaurants with tools designed to help save time and manage food spend all on one platform. Learn more at EasyCater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Both presidential campaigns are in the Midwest today as they make last-ditch efforts to court the undecided voters who could lift them into the White House. Former President Trump was in Dearborn, Michigan, a predominantly Arab American city near Detroit. Vice President Harris was in Wisconsin, one of the blue wall states that she needs to win. With just days to go before voting ends, Trump and Harris are tied in both these states, as well as five others that will decide the election. Action. Joining us now to discuss all of this is NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hey, Mara.
Hi, Elsa.
All right, let's start with Trump. Why do you think he chose to be in Dearborn today?
Dearborn has a lot of Arab American communities. You know, he got the mayor of nearby Hamtramck, Michigan, the first Arab American and Muslim mayor of the city to endorse him. And the Arab American community in Michigan has in large part turned against the Biden administration because of Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. Gaza is a giant wedge issue for Republicans to use against Democrats because it splits the Democratic coalition in Michigan. And Donald Trump went to Dearborn today to see if he could widen that gap some more, get more Arab American voters away from Harris. They used to be pretty reliable Democratic voters, but he's telling them, and he told them today, that despite the fact that he's been basically joined at the hip with Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu throughout his first term, his message to them today was, there's going to be peace in the Middle East if I'm elected.
Well, this, of course, follows a week of controversy on the trail, right? Like, Democrats pounced on Trump's remarks about Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, pointing to the violent imagery that Trump invoked while calling Cheney a war hawk. Cheney, of course, has endorsed Harris. Here's what Trump said.
She's a radical war hawk. Let's put her with a rifle standing there with nine barrels shooting at her, okay? Let's see how she feels about it. You know, when the guns are trained on her face.
What do you make of all this, Mara?
Well, let's first say how Liz Cheney responded. After all, she's the one who had Trump describe what sounded a lot like a firing squad. She said on X, quote, "This is how dictators destroy free nations. They threaten those who speak against them with death. We cannot entrust our country and our freedom to a petty, vindictive, cruel, unstable man who wants to be a tyrant." But this is just the latest in a very long line of violent rhetoric from Trump. He said that there should be military tribunals for Obama and Hillary Clinton. He said the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, should be tried for treason. He also said Liz Cheney should be tried for treason. He's talked about using the military against the enemy within, who he's identified as Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi, and others. He's even talked about putting Mark Zuckerberg in prison for life. So this is Donald Trump's modus operandi. But in the closing days, it does seem to have intensified and become an integral part of his closing argument. Harris addressed this when she was in Wisconsin today. Let's take a listen to what she said.
His rhetoric has grown more extreme, and he is even less focused than before on the needs and the concerns and the challenges facing the American people.
I mean, so that's her closing argument.
Yeah.
He's unhinged. He only cares about his grievances, not your problems.
Well, what do you think? Like, was this some kind of strategy, or is this Trump just speaking off the cuff?
Well, there are two theories on this. There are some Republicans who think he's just being undisciplined. He shouldn't be doing this. Nikki Haley the other day criticized the Madison Square Garden Trump rally for being overly masculine, saying it turns off suburban women. But other Republicans say if you want to get those low propensity voters, white non-college men, off the sidelines, you're going to have to make them pretty angry or pretty scared. Extreme rhetoric can do that, get them off the sidelines. But the problem with that theory, of course, is that other voters hear that rhetoric too, not just his base. And Donald Trump has always motivated people to vote for him and people to vote against him.
Okay. Well, the Democrats had their own controversy, right? Like President Biden's use of the word garbage and how the White House reportedly modified the transcript of his remarks. All of that prompted a backlash as well. How is that affecting the Harris campaign?
Well, it certainly was a distraction from what they wanted people to pay attention to was that comedian at the Madison Square Garden rally saying that Puerto Rico was a pile of garbage. I think the Biden controversy took some attention away from that, but the Harris campaign does believe that the comments of that comedian has hurt him in the Hispanic community, that there's a big backlash. Harris is going to Allentown, Pennsylvania on Monday, which is a majority Latino community, and I am sure she will be talking about this.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson. Thank you so much, Mara.
Thank you.
Let's head overseas now to Spain, where rescue and recovery teams are still working to access locations where they may find more bodies drowned by flash flooding earlier this week. At least 200 people have died around the city of Valencia from what has become Spain's worst natural disaster in recent memory. NPR's Miguel Macias joins us from Seville. Hey, Miguel.
Hi, Marlies.
Hey, what is the latest there?
Still watching closely that terrible death count rise because as of today, there were areas like the town of Alfafar, right outside of Valencia, where help had not been received yet. There are still houses and cars left to examine. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez reassured citizens yesterday that the government was there for them. Let's hear what he said.
No vamos a dejar solos a los valencianos y a las valencianas. Vamos a estar con vosotros y con vosotras.
Sanchez said that the government will not let citizens of Valencia down. It will deploy all resources available. Today, in fact, the army sent 500 more members from its emergency response unit, and police units are being deployed from other cities to help with public safety. Today was a national holiday in Spain, and we got to see some images of hope, finally. People in Valencia picked up water, food, and other things that might help and simply walked to the most impacted areas in the outskirts of the city to help.
And do we know what the impact has been? I mean, how extensive this damage might prove to be?
I don't think we know yet how much damage there is. There are entire towns where homes have been destroyed, infrastructure as big as bridges have been swept away by rivers of brown water. Think about it almost as a tsunami, I would say. This wasn't just water accumulating on the streets. You can see videos where a wave of brown water advancing on the streets until they turned into violent rivers. Communications have been drastically disrupted, with nearly 50 miles of railway completely destroyed. Long lines of trucks have been stuck on blocked highways, their products sometimes going bad. And of course, there's the emotional toll. People are devastated, sometimes angry at what they see as a lack of a swift response.
Yeah, I mean, it must just be exhausting for people there. Given how severe it sounds like the storm was, Miguel, are people talking about whether anything could have been done to avoid that awful death toll, the human tragedy here?
Yes, there's actually quite a bit of controversy around the way citizens were alerted on Tuesday. The official agency that oversees weather events, it's called IMET, started to warn citizens as far back as Thursday the 24th. That's 5 days before the storm. IMET also issued warnings, including a red level alert for the area on Tuesday early morning around 7 a.m. But the direct alert, the beeping cell phone loud alert from the regional government of Valencia went out just past 8 p.m. that night. There is testimony showing that by that time, the flooding was up to 2 meters in some areas. This is also rush hour in Spain, so many cars on the road going back home. In other words, the destruction was going to happen regardless, but the tremendous human toll might have been avoided.
It's NPR's Miguel Macias in Seville, Spain. Thanks, Miguel.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
With just days left in the 2024 campaign, former President Donald Trump continues to preemptively hammer the idea that if he doesn't win, it means the election was stolen.
It's the only way we're going to lose because they cheat. They cheat like hell.
Our voting correspondent puts Trump's false claims under the microscope and explains how to tell election fact from fiction. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for Weekend All Things Considered tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock on your KPR stations.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
Stay with us. News headlines coming up in just a moment. Mostly clear skies this evening, then partly cloudy with lows in the mid-40s. 70% chance of rain tomorrow afternoon with highs in the lower 60s. It's 4:30.
All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Coming up, we'll report on the new face of Hezbollah.
After the group's longtime leader was killed in an Israeli airstrike.
I think Hezbollah knows a political exit is going to be the only way out eventually, and is preparing itself for that scenario.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. U.S. intelligence officials say a video purported to show a group of Haitians illegally voting in Georgia was manufactured by Russian influence actors. Sam Greenglass of member station WABE reports.
The intelligence community says the video is part of Russia's broader effort to raise unfounded questions about the election and stoke divisions. Disinformation expert Nina Jankowicz says social media platforms are less equipped or willing to take action than in the past.
Trust and safety teams have been decimated, and the folks that are still there are doing really yeoman's work, but it is like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet hole.
The video was amplified by some Georgia supporters of former President Donald Trump. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who quickly debunked the video, wrote in a statement that, quote, "We can't let our enemies use lies to divide us." For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
In the Middle East, Israeli forces damaged offices of the UN agency in charge of Palestinian affairs in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, but the Israeli military issued a statement denying responsibility. As we hear from NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv.
The damaged offices belong to the UN Aid Agency for Palestinians, or UNRWA, in the Nur Shams camp in the West Bank. The Israeli military raided the camp during what it called a, quote, counterterrorism operation. The head of UNRWA, Felipe Lazzarini, tweeted that Israeli forces bulldozed the offices beyond use, which he says were a hub for basic services for more than 14,000 Palestinians in the camp. In a statement, the Israeli military denied Lazzarini's account, saying that, quote, terrorists planted explosives near the offices, which were then detonated. Relations between Israel and UNRWA have been increasingly strained. Israeli parliament voted earlier this week to ban the organization, which would severely impact aid in both Gaza and the West Bank.
That's Kat Lonsdorf. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Kansas tax collections came in below estimates in October. Emily Yonker reports.
Kansas tax collections were about 3.4%, or $23.4 million, lower than state estimates. It's driven largely by corporate income tax collections, which came in nearly 37% below estimates. Total tax revenue is down 2.5% from this time last year. October marks the first month since May that Kansas tax collections were below the forecast. Overall, the state retains a healthy surplus, but the budget forecast for the rest of the fiscal year will be updated later this month. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Emily Yonker.
Candidates in one of the key contested races in the Kansas legislature sat down for a debate today on radio station KCUR. Competing to represent State Senate District 10 in Shawnee, incumbent Republican Mike Thompson and Democratic challenger Andrew Moll traded barbs on Medicaid expansion, cannabis legalization, and abortion. Kansas law bars abortions at 22 weeks, but provides exceptions in cases of rape, incest, or when the mother's life is in danger. Thompson said those exceptions go against his personal beliefs.
There's a difference between my personal opinion and what we have in the state legally right now.
Moll says he supports Kansas laws that permit abortion access, including those exceptions. An animal shelter in northeast Kansas is closed and under quarantine due to a highly contagious virus. KSNT reports that the animal shelter in Holton entered quarantine after a puppy was found to have a dangerous virus. The Humane Society in Jackson County says it is closing for 2 weeks because of canine parvovirus. Parvo spreads easily and has already killed one puppy at the shelter. Mostly clear skies this evening for northeast and east central Kansas, becoming partly cloudy, lows tonight in the mid-40s. Cloudy tomorrow. Chance of rain in the morning, but in the afternoon we have a 70% chance of showers. Highs only reaching the lower 60s. Tomorrow night, nearly a 100% chance of showers and storms. Near steady temperatures in the upper 50s. It's 4:35.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here. Reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump. A tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Once again this year, Donald Trump is running for the presidency against a woman. The last time that happened, 2016, it helped create a historic divide between men and women at the ballot box. Now that gap is back, and it is not just the candidates' genders driving that. There's abortion, there's campaign strategy, and a host of other factors expanding that divide in this year's election. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben asked voters and pollsters what's going on.
Here's something a Democrat and a Republican can agree on. The gender gap this year could be huge.
Not only is it likely to be historically big, and 2016 it was quite big, but secondly, it's historically pervasive. Every single demographic group right now has a gender gap.
That was Democratic pollster Celinda Lake. And here's Republican pollster Whit Ayers.
This has the potential to be something close to a gender chasm.
In 2016, the gender gap was historically big, with women preferring Clinton and men preferring Trump by sizable margins. In 2020, that gap shrank by half. But this year, polls suggest it could balloon, ending up even bigger than in 2016. There are a lot of reasons for that, but Lake says the main one is obvious.
Abortion is the absolute catalyst for it, and it's really accentuated it because it's really fueled registration.
Abortion is top of mind for Amanda Burns from North Carolina, who is voting for Kamala Harris.
I never anticipated experiencing anything like this as far as like rights being walked back for people in this country. It really is terrifying. I'm just terrified.
Burns sees the gender gap manifesting in her own life.
I do have a lot of family where the men do support Trump. I take it personally when you're voting for somebody who is going to put people in power who are going to take my rights away, my daughter's rights away.
In the last few years, the number of women who identify as pro-choice has shot up, according to Gallup. Meanwhile, some men, young men in particular, have become more Republican. John Della Volpe, a pollster at Harvard, has found that young men have shifted by 14 points toward the GOP since 2020. That's not about abortion, says Ayers.
I think it's much more the Hulk Hogan professional wrestling persona of some of Trump's supporters and rallies.
Hulk Hogan, who showed up at both Trump's recent rally at Madison Square Garden and before that, the RNC.
With our leader up there, my hero, that gladiator, we're going to bring America back together.
It's not that young men are in love with Hogan. It's more that Trump has cultivated a macho persona that the ex-pro wrestler fits with nicely. Trump shows up at UFC fights and has also appeared on podcasts hosted by guys like Logan Paul and Theo Vaughn, shows with heavily male audiences. While Josh Austin stood in line for a recent Trump rally in Greensboro, North Carolina, I asked why he thinks there might be a gender gap among younger voters.
If you look at America, man, you would think of somebody more like Trump. Somebody stronger, somebody tall, somebody who wants to do nothing but be successful.
Voters' other identities beyond gender complicate all of this. Trump has, for example, been reaching out to Black and Latino men who have historically leaned Democratic. There's also a wide educational gap that intersects with gender. College-educated women are highly supportive of Harris. Non-college men, meanwhile, are among Trump's strongest supporters. To Lake, the Democratic pollster, that makes sense.
Blue-collar men really feel like they are being disrespected. They are losing their advantage. And the politics of resentment and economic grievance is very high with blue-collar men.
Women, meanwhile, have historically been divided by marriage status, with unmarried women voting heavily Democratic. Joe Serrano, an auto technician in Virginia, says he sees a lot of women with liberal politics, and they tend to be single. Meanwhile,
decent women that I personally know, that are more like they want a family, they want to meet a good man, you know, and they have these aspirations of women that are married. Those are the ones that are more typically seen entertaining the possibility of voting for Trump.
One other factor this year is simply that a woman is running. Consider how much the gap shrank in 2020 when Trump ran against a man. Now it appears to have grown. At a Michigan union event this month, Matthew Paris said he sees this.
A lot of people that I know in my age group, some feel like that they're not ready for a woman to run the country.
Even beyond all this, there are countless other unquantifiable influences on the gap. More than 24 women have accused Trump of sexual misconduct, including two who came out in recent weeks. There's also just the way Trump and his allies sometimes talk about women. Here's investor Grant Cardone attacking Harris at that Madison Square Garden rally.
She's a fake, a fraud. She's a pretender. Her and her pimp handlers will destroy our country.
Given all of that, it could be easy to make this gap all about Trump. But that would be a mistake, Lake cautions.
Younger women have been getting more liberal over time. Younger men have not. Even if we restore abortion, and even if Trump isn't running, we're going to see this phenomenon.
Whatever the exit polls say, then, it won't just tell us something about this year. It could be a sign of things to come. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Hezbollah has a new leader. He replaces Hassan Nasrallah, the longtime head of the Iran-backed militant and political group, who was killed by a massive Israeli airstrike in Lebanon in September. NPR's Arzu Rizvani reports on the new face of Hezbollah.
Naeem Qassem was never really meant to lead Hezbollah, but Israel has killed so much of the group's top brass in recent weeks that he was pretty much the last man standing.
One of the key things about the new leader of Hezbollah is how uninteresting he is.
That's Lena Khatib. She's a fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. She says Qassem lacks the charisma and magnetism Nasrallah had, as well as his religious standing. He wears a white turban signifying no lineage that can be traced back to the Prophet Muhammad. But the 70-year-old cleric, who was Nasrallah's longtime deputy, does offer a steady and familiar hand at a time of great uncertainty.
Even though he is not considered to be very remarkable, he is respected by Hezbollah's constituents. So in a way, Hezbollah wants to reassure this community by conveying a sense of continuity and a sense of resilience.
In his first televised speech this week as Hezbollah's new leader, Qassem vowed to carry on his predecessor's vision and to keep fighting Israel. As he spoke, Israel carried out a wave of heavy airstrikes in Lebanon's eastern city of Baalbek after tens of thousands of residents fled following evacuation orders by Israel's military. Under Qassem, the war goes on. But his years of political experience suggest there is also a way out with him at the helm.
Hezbollah has not changed course and selected, for example, a primarily military leader, which is, for instance, what Hamas did with their selection of the now assassinated Yahya Sinwar. I think Hezbollah knows a political exit is going to be the only way out eventually, and is preparing itself for that scenario.
With so many of Hezbollah's top leaders now gone, time is not on Naeem Qassem's side. Soon after he was announced to be the head of Hezbollah, Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, weighed in with a not-so-subtle threat. He said on Twitter that it would be a, quote, temporary appointment that wouldn't last long. Arzu Rizvani, NPR News, Beirut.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Many Northeast states are counting on offshore wind energy to bring jobs, confront human-driven climate change, and help keep the lights on. Construction is underway on several wind farms off the Atlantic coast. But WBUR's Miriam Wasser reports there's anxiety about how the presidential election will affect the young industry.
It takes all kinds of people to build an offshore wind farm, like ironworker Rachel Jackson.
This is a famous ironworker sound. That's how you know an ironworker is coming, because the wrenches are clacking together.
Jackson's preparing for another stint on the water. She picks up the safety harness she'll bring with her.
Can I feel it? How heavy
is
it?
Yeah. This is an empty one.
Oh, my God.
But it's different like holding it and putting it on
30 pounds.
Jackson loves the job. It pays well, and she feels like she's working on something important for the planet. But she worries about the future. The Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, says he'll stop the offshore wind industry if he wins.
I do not want him to pull us out of this opportunity because it is work and it could be something that is beneficial to the environment.
Jackson is not the only one concerned about jobs and the environment. Chris Olith directs the Special Initiative on Offshore Wind, an independent think tank that supports the industry. She says there's a lot at stake for offshore wind in this election.
Kamala Harris is a strong proponent of clean energy, you know, versus a candidate who said, quote, on day one, end quote, he will do everything in his power to stop offshore wind.
Harris doesn't have a detailed offshore wind platform, but she's expected to continue President Biden's policies to get thousands of turbines up and running by 2030. If Trump wins, experts say it's unlikely he could stop operating wind farms or those under construction. But he could make things difficult for projects still in the pipeline by slow-walking permits or rescinding important clean energy tax credits. Eric Hines leads the Offshore Wind Energy Graduate Program at Tufts University.
We should all fasten our seatbelts. You know, there will be more drama to come, just as there has been up to date.
Wind developers say they're nervous, but they don't think a second Trump administration would be catastrophic. They point to popular investments in wind manufacturing and shipbuilding, including in conservative states like Louisiana and Texas. Plus, many states in the Northeast need this power. Electricity demand is surging, and offshore wind is probably the only feasible way to meet it without exacerbating climate change.
Offshore wind is vital for us to meet our clean energy and climate goals.
Rebecca Tepper is Massachusetts Energy Secretary. She says even if offshore wind stalls during a second Trump administration, states can still do a lot, like build new transmission lines and plan for future offshore wind projects.
Whether it's Trump or anybody else, we need to keep our eye on the ball and keep trying to move the industry forward in whatever ways that we can.
And the industry is moving forward. From Massachusetts to Virginia, turbines are going up in the water. Wind advocate Amber Hewitt stands on the deck of a boat 15 miles off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. About 24 turbines poke out of the ocean like little stick figures. It's the Vineyard Wind Project, the country's first large-scale offshore wind farm to start construction.
I feel like we just drove to Europe. Like, this is a really it's a really inspiring moment for me to see this many offshore wind turbines in U.S. waters.
Hewitt leads the offshore wind program at the National Wildlife Federation. She says this project shows the industry's momentum.
It's too promising of an opportunity to ever really be stopped in its tracks here.
So while she's anxious about the November election, Hewitt says the outcome won't make or break the young offshore wind industry. For NPR News, I'm Miriam Wasser.
This is All Things Considered.
This is Nick Carswell. Join me this Saturday at 5 p.m. on KPR for 105 Live, where we continue to showcase new music made right here in Kansas. Our live session this week comes from the stage of the Bottleneck with the Draper Family Band.
This is Brandon Draper from the Draper Family Band. Join us for our live studio session on 105 Live on Kansas Public Radio.
5 o'clock tomorrow evening on your KPR1 stations. It's 105 Live from the University of Kansas. This is KPR 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 99.5 FM in Manhattan, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Do you own a business and value the programs on KPR? Your fellow Kansas Public Radio listeners could be your best customers. Support KPR and reach your fellow public radio fans by becoming a corporate sponsor. Learn more at sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org.
Stay tuned. News headlines coming your way at 5:01. Then we'll talk about the latest jobs report. Sharp slowdown in hiring last month, but economists are warning that the figures may have been distorted, and we will explain why. We will also take a look at how whichever candidate wins the presidency could affect the course of the wars Israel is fighting in the Mideast.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the new exotic sounds of the Blue Zombies and Cloud 11, plus a brand new album by Herb Alpert.
Music.
I'm Daryl Brogdon. Come join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour, Saturday night at 7 on KPR.
On a Friday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Maybe you saw kids trick-or-treating last night dressed as zombies. Well, there is another kind of zombie that's much scarier. NPR's investigations team has been looking into what are called zombie second mortgages. These are loans taken out 20 years ago that homeowners thought were dead, but they rise from the grave when companies try to collect or foreclose. Now Massachusetts is going after one of those companies and helping hundreds of homeowners. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
A zombie is pretty scary, and so are these loans when they come back to life. People can lose their homes before they even really know what's going on.
That's exactly right. It puts people's homes at risk. So it is scary.
That's Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell. Her office investigated a company named Franklin Credit Management and found that it was allegedly violating state and federal law by trying to collect money that homeowners didn't actually owe. Before these loans were zombies, they started out as second mortgages that many people got when they bought a house back during the housing bubble. After the crash, many of the loans were basically worthless, and homeowners say they were told that the loans were resolved through loan modifications. But now that home prices have risen so much, some companies are claiming that the loans are still valid, and they're moving to collect.
If you look at zombie second mortgages, the process itself is unfair. You have folks who legitimately believe that they have paid a debt or that it has been done away with, and now you have a random company and random strangers coming back decades later to push them to pay something they haven't received a statement on, they knew nothing about, and are often blindsided.
Now, Campbell struck a settlement with Franklin Credit. Franklin declined an interview and in a statement denied the allegations and said it does not admit wrongdoing. But the AG's office says Franklin has agreed to change its business practices if it seeks to collect on mortgages in the state in the future. And it's agreed to stop all efforts to collect on its entire portfolio of mortgages for people in Massachusetts. How many homeowners are being helped here?
Approximately 518 borrowers. Which, of course, is sizable.
Still, the settlement involves just one company in just one state. A recent NPR investigation looked across several states and found at least 10,000 zombie second mortgages with foreclosure activity. So there are still a lot of homeowners getting demands to pay these old zombie loans. And some of them have been losing their houses. Andrea Bopp Stark is an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center. She hopes this settlement by the AG in Massachusetts is just the beginning.
I think it's groundbreaking. I think it's really hopeful because it's kind of a roadmap for other states to use, not just against Franklin, but any debt buyer or lender who is engaging in this kind of conduct with zombie second mortgages.
NPR's investigation in the state of Maryland uncovered the names of dozens of companies that were moving to foreclose on homes over these old zombie loans. The Maryland AG's office says it's received complaints about some of those companies. It won't comment on whether or not it's investigating. Both the Maryland and Massachusetts AGs encourage people to contact their offices if they feel debt collectors are trying to collect money that they don't actually owe. Bob Stark would like to see the federal government take more action, specifically the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Rohit Chopra is the director of the bureau. He says he's aware of the problem of these old zombie loans.
Well, it's certainly something that freaks a lot of us out. We don't want to see some of the worst relics of the financial crisis come back to haunt people. And we're often worried that really old debt that may be invalid is being sold and resold and often threatening people when it comes to their financial lives.
Bob Stark says if the Bureau really is concerned about that, it could clarify exactly what the rules are with this old debt. For example, that debt collectors can't charge a mountain of retroactive interest on an old mortgage if a homeowner wasn't even receiving monthly statements for many years. She says that would be crucial to help homeowners fight off these zombie loans and debt collectors. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
An estimated 200,000 people packed into downtown Los Angeles today to celebrate the LA Dodgers' World Series win over the New York Yankees. It's the team's 8th World Series title overall, their first championship parade since 1988. NPR's Kelly McEvers was there.
The parade started at City Hall. L.A. Mayor Karen Bass said she'd be sending a Dodgers jersey to New York City Mayor Eric Adams. But most people didn't see that. Downtown was so packed by that point, the best hope to see anything was to climb a tree. I met the Rodriguez family waiting in a long line for the porta potties. They've been here since 6 a.m.
I've been a Dodger fan since I was born. I got baby pictures, everything. This is my pops right here.
That's Daniel Rodriguez with his dad, Daniel Rodriguez. Younger Daniel's wearing one of those old-school bright blue 80s-style Dodgers satin jackets like manager Tommy Lasorda used to wear.
This is my great-grandpa's jacket.
No way.
Yeah, my great-grandpa's jacket.
From what year?
From, what was it, probably 90-something?
I got it from him in 1997.
Is he still with us?
No, not anymore.
Daniel Sr. tells me about his first Dodger game in 1985. He's originally from Guatemala. He says he and his grandpa, the owner of the jacket, walked the whole way to the stadium. His wife, Sandra, says she got into the Dodgers when she was young with her mom.
As a kid, I remember her listening to the radio. It means a lot. It means a lot.
The family says this parade is extra special. The 2020 season was short because of COVID. The Dodgers won the World Series that year, but there was no parade.
I know we won in 2020. It felt good. I loved it. But we didn't get to do all this, you know?
This parade is about to make its way to us. Sandra says we should get in position.
I got my son-in-law up on the tree.
Okay, cool. Oh, wow,
come
cool.
With us.
All right, let's do it. We join up with her daughter, Natalie, who just got married. It's her husband who's up in the tree. Natalie says they showed World Series Game 2 at her wedding reception.
We told the DJ, like, when he got there, I was like, okay, like, if when the Dodgers win that third out, like, and it doesn't matter what's going on during the wedding, I need you to play I Love L.A. And he did. Everyone was crazy. Because we're big Dodger fans.
Pretty soon we see the buses come around the corner, double-deckers, with players, owners, coaches, and family waving and throwing flowers. At that point, it's just a wall of yelling. It all goes by really fast, and then it's over.
I want to cry. I think for my husband, I know he's been waiting for this forever. My son, my daughter. Yeah, I'm really emotional. This is beautiful.
Kelly McEvers, NPR News, downtown Los Angeles.
Let's go, Dodgers! Happy Friday! You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Organic Valley, a dairy cooperative of small organic family farms that is dedicated to protecting the land and all the plants and animals that live there. Learn more about Organic Valley at ov.coop. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Morning Edition from NPR News asks the crucial questions of our time.
Who can make the best cookie, humans or AI?
Unpack the answers with us every weekday.
Join us for Morning Edition, 5 to 9 a.m. Monday through Friday on your KPR stations. Your local host is Jay Schaefer. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3. KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Two more hours of All Things Considered coming right up. We start everything off with an update of news headlines. It's 5 o'clock.
Just open up the report this morning, it might make your stomach drop a little bit. But fortunately, as you dive into the data, there's some other things going on here definitely underneath the surface.
How much did a strike at Boeing factories and a pair of hurricanes slow down hiring last month?
It's Friday, November 1st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Ahead this hour, when it comes to immigration restrictions and enforcement, some of President Biden's policies look an awful lot like former President Trump's.
The Democratic Party is adopting the same policies that the MAGA Republicans have been advocating for.
Plus, if you are not quite done yet with Halloween this year,
we've got news of a long-lost short story by the author of Dracula.
Spotted an advert for a short story by Bram Stoker called Gibbet Hill, and I went, what the heck? I have never seen that before in my life.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Housing costs are a top concern for many voters. As NPR's Laura Walmsley reports, former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris are proposing different ideas for addressing the country's housing woes.
Harris and Trump agree on a few ideas to bring down housing costs, including building more homes, cutting red tape, and opening up some public lands for housing. Harris is calling for 3 million new homes and tax credits that would encourage building more affordable apartments and starter homes. She also wants to give $25,000 in down payment assistance to first-time home buyers who qualify, though economists warn that those payments could push some home prices higher. Trump, meanwhile, says he will slash inflation to bring down mortgage rates. Many economists, though, say his proposals would drive inflation higher. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News, Washington.
Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk has lost his bid to move the case involving his million-dollar-at-a-time giveaways to federal court. A judge denying Musk's bid to move his case out of Pennsylvania state court. Musk has been giving $1 million checks to randomly selected voters who sign a petition supporting free speech and gun rights. Philadelphia's Democratic Attorney General Lawrence Krasner sued Musk and his political action committee, calling that program an illegal lottery. Musk so far has given nearly $120 million to support Trump's campaign. Hospitals in Texas must begin asking patients for their citizenship status under an executive order that took effect today. The goal to document how much money is spent caring for undocumented immigrants.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott believes taxpayers should not have to fund the care for people who are unlawfully present in the country. He hopes to use the data collected to track how much is being spent so that he can ask for a reimbursement from the federal government. Hospitals haven't stated exactly how they will comply with the order yet, and any response from a patient will not affect whether they receive care or not. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, $20 billion of Texans' taxes were used to fund Medicaid in fiscal year 2023. I'm Blaze Ganey in Austin.
What's known as the Day of the Dead is being observed this evening and into tomorrow in Mexico and elsewhere. NPR's Ader Peralta reports from a popular market in Mexico City.
The belief here is that the ancestors make a long trek back to Earth to partake in a celebration with the living. So at this market, the living are getting ready. They are buying marigolds to adorn their altars. They're buying fresh ingredients, chocolate and red ancho chilies, bunches of cilantros, yellow, purple, and red corn to make comfort food. Everything here is sweet and shiny and fragrant. It's special to welcome the dead back home. Ada Peralta, NPR News, at Mercado Jamaica in Mexico City.
Stocks wound out the session in positive territory today. The Dow was up 288 points. The Nasdaq rose 144 points. This is NPR. Device maker Apple appears to have broken its summer iPhone sales slump. In a sign, demand for its most important product appears to be picking up. Apple says iPhone sales rose 6% from the same period a year ago for the July through September quarter to $46.2 billion. That reverses two consecutive year-over-year declines in quarterly iPhone sales. Public health officials are warning more pregnant women who are addicted to fentanyl are being exposed to xylazine. Researchers and doctors say they're not sure how the chemical is affecting women or their babies. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
Drug gangs are mixing xylazine, a potent animal tranquilizer, with fentanyl. The cocktail's highly addictive, making it harder for pregnant women to enter recovery. And xylazine causes devastating skin lesions. Dr. Ilana Hall, a doctor at the University of Pittsburgh, co-authored one of the first studies of xylazine's impact on pregnant women.
Our patients know that this is out there, and they're scared and they're terrified, and they are very worried about, you know, potential impacts on their pregnancies, on their deliveries, on their infants.
Physicians and researchers are scrambling to find xylazine treatments as the U.S. street drug supply grows more and more toxic. Brian Mann, NPR News.
U.S. intelligence officials say a video purporting to show election fraud in Georgia is fake and most likely the work of Russian actors. Video shows a person claiming to be a Haitian immigrant talking about how he intends to vote multiple times in two Georgia counties for Vice President Harris. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger quickly declared the video an obvious fake, and the FBI and others echoed that finding today. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
You're listening to KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
KPR's Community Spotlight program values organizations that share our commitment to the arts, education, health, well-being, sustainability, and diversity of the areas we serve, and will highlight a nonprofit each month using KPR's airwaves. Applications at kansaspublicradio.org.
It's 65 degrees in Lawrence, 68 in Manhattan. It is 5:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The headline on this morning's jobs report suggests hiring in the U.S. slowed to a crawl last month. But economists say don't put too much stock in that one, admittedly, discouraging number. The reason? The ongoing strike at Boeing factories in the Pacific Northwest distorted the government's monthly tally of jobs. So did that pair of back-to-back hurricanes that disrupted business in the Southeast. NPR's Scott Horsley joins me. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Hey, so any headline, any news, especially big economic news, feels huge this close to Election Day. And in an election when voters say the economy is a top concern, against that backdrop, what should we make of this jobs report?
Probably not too much. You know, it would be nice with an election 4 days out to have a really clear signal about the strength of the job market. Unfortunately, though, the signals in today's report are pretty murky, clouded by those storms and that strike. That's why economists like Corey Staley at the Indeed Hiring Lab say you shouldn't be too dismayed by the headline showing employers added a measly 12,000 jobs in October.
If you just open up the report this morning, it might make your stomach drop a little bit. But fortunately, as you kind of like dive into the data, there's some other things going on here definitely underneath the surface.
We know, for example, the Boeing strike, which is now 7 weeks old, idled more than 40,000 workers. That accounts for nearly the entire drop in manufacturing jobs last month. The effects of the hurricanes, Helene and Milton, are harder to quantify, but they surely put a temporary dent in employment. And those storms made landfall just shortly before the government conducted its monthly headcount of workers.
What if we just took those storms and the strike out of the equation? I mean, do we know how the job market would be performing without them?
Most economists think the job market is cooling down, but only gradually, not falling off a cliff. And one sign of that is the unemployment rate, which held steady last month at a low 4.1%. If the job market were really falling apart, you would expect to see some increase in the unemployment rate. So that's reassuring. Now, there are other signs that hiring has slowed down from what had been a blistering pace. You know, the number of job openings has come down. Employers are no longer bidding up wages as fast as they had been to recruit workers. But Staley says wages are still climbing, and now that inflation's cooled off, workers' paychecks are actually stretching further than they used to.
People are still getting, you know, decent raises, you know, good news for workers. And then as you look even outside the labor market, we see, you know, GDP is still strong. We see consumer spending. Overall, when we take all of these indicators into account, this is a solid labor market we're still in.
Now, one other footnote in today's jobs report. Because of a quirk in the calendar, employers had less time than usual to respond to the government survey, and a lot of employers just didn't respond. So that also may have skewed the count. We're going to have to watch and see if these numbers bounce back next month.
Although, before then, in fact, next week, we have some big decisions to make. There's the presidential election, of course, and also the Federal Reserve meeting to decide about interest rates, right?
Yeah, just 2 days after the election, Fed policymakers are going to meet here in Washington and decide whether to cut interest rates again. The Fed's keeping a close eye on the job market, and the weaker the job market seems, the more aggressive the central bank might be in cutting rates. If you took today's jobs report at face value, you might expect another supersized rate cut from the Fed, but, you know, markets are not taking this report at face value. Investors think the Fed is going to proceed cautiously and probably cut rates by a modest quarter percentage point next week.
Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
NPR Scott Horsley.
How could the next president change the course of the wars that Israel is fighting in the Middle East? Well, as NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv, U.S. elections are already making a difference in Israel's calculations.
It's no secret that Israel's right-wing leaders hope former President Donald Trump returns to the White House. Tali Gottlieb, a lawmaker in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party, told NPR at a rally, "Of course I don't want Kamala Harris, who thinks we're committing a genocide in Gaza, to be elected." The vice president has not said Israel is committing a genocide. A poll of Israelis this week found only 17% favor Harris, 66% favor Trump. Both candidates want a quick end to Israel's wars in Gaza and Lebanon, but in different ways, says Shmuel Rosner, an Israeli commentator on American politics.
I think with Kamala Harris, Israel will probably expect a more confrontational approach that aims to, in some ways, tie Israel's hands. With Donald Trump, it seems as if Israel is going to be somewhat freer to pursue the war the way it wants to do it, without putting too much restrictions.
A Harris administration and Israel would struggle to find common ground on post-war Gaza. Harris has said there should be no reduction to Gaza's territory, while many in Israel's right wing are calling to seize at least part of Gaza's land after Hamas's attack last year. Amit Segal, a commentator perceived as being close to Netanyahu, said on Israeli TV, if Trump is elected, Israel may, quote, change the borders of the Gaza Strip as punishment for what happened on October 7th. In Gaza, NPR producer Anas Baba met Alaeddin Abu Hassera looking for flour rations. He said Trump and Harris are, quote, the same thing. Nothing will change. They're both watching us die. Regarding the West Bank, Trump's former ambassador to Israel has a new book advocating Israel annex that occupied territory. Palestinian analyst Ibrahim Dalalsha of the Horizon Center think tank says Harris would oppose West Bank annexation, but would not solve the core of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
It would be like a smarter conflict management kind of policy. But I don't expect it to be a strategic intervention to resolve the conflict.
The Biden administration has stepped up efforts to resolve the conflicts in Lebanon and Gaza. Any achievement could help Harris in the elections. Nadav Strauchler, a political strategist who previously worked closely with Netanyahu, says Netanyahu is waiting.
In the current situation, it could have done more to help this administration to gain more points, maybe. But it won't run to do it right now. I don't see him rushing for a deal until the election. He will wait. So this is something that doesn't help this administration and maybe somehow does help Trump.
Iran is one front where the identity of the next president could matter most. After Israel's bombing of Iranian air defenses last week, Israeli officials are beginning to promote an idea that used to seem out of the question, bombing Iran's nuclear weapons capabilities. Israel would need U.S. support to do that.
Netanyahu sees it as the story of his life to change the situation with Iran. I think he was waiting for the election and he seek for the option to finish this threat.
He thinks Netanyahu sees a better chance to do that with Trump in office. But this might be Netanyahu's big ask, no matter who is in the White House next. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
A different election will happen this weekend across the Atlantic. Members of Britain's Conservative Party will elect a new member. Whoever wins will be tasked with rebuilding the political party of Churchill and Thatcher after its worst ever election defeat. NPR's Lauren Freyre reports from London.
And as Big Ben strikes 10, a Labour landslide.
Blimey, the Conservative Party looks pulverised tonight.
Britain's Conservatives were pulverised at the polls this summer, despite dominating politics here for more than a century. Robert Lord Haywood, a Conservative member of the House of Lords, says the way his party is now trying to rebuild is by playing to the extremes.
A certain element of the British population is watching what's happening in the United States. You can't avoid it.
Haywood says moderates have been voted out of this leadership contest by fellow MPs, and the last two candidates standing...
They're not actually household names in the United Kingdom, which is why they've gone for a populist approach to attract the headlines.
Politicians on this side of the Atlantic are also diving into culture wars by saying stuff like this.
Of course, not all cultures are equally valid. I don't believe in cultural relativism. I believe in Western values.
That's Kemi Badenoch, the frontrunner to lead the UK Conservative Party, arguing on TV that immigrants from certain cultures should be more welcome here than others. She's also said she thinks paid maternity leave is, quote, excessive, and that while her parents are wealthy, she herself is working class because she worked a fast food job as a teenager.
Now, lots of Brits quickly made fun of her, saying, you can't just be working class because you had a job at McDonald's.
Katie Balls is political editor of The Spectator, a right-leaning magazine here. She says Badenoch...
She is very much known for talking about identity politics. She's sometimes depicted as an anti-woke warrior.
Now, some see that as an unlikely role for Badenoch. She's a black woman and a mother of three who grew up in Nigeria.
And people listen to her in the way if it was a man they may not have done.
Badenoch would make history as the first black leader of any major UK party. Her challenger, fellow MP Robert Jenrick, is most famous for quitting a cabinet post over a proposal to deport migrants to Rwanda in Africa.
Davis has called it moral delinquency, and the Times reported that Prince Charles privately called the plan appalling.
The Rwanda plan was panned by human rights groups and overturned by the courts. But for Jenrick, it wasn't tough enough. He's also called for peaceful protesters to be arrested if they chant Allahu Akbar, God is great, at pro-Palestinian rallies. And he told a pro-Israel group that he wants the Star of David posted at UK borders.
So that at every airport and point of entry to our great country, there is the Star of David there. As a symbol that we support Israel, we stand with Israel, we are friends and allies.
Now, some of these views might not seem out of place in U.S. political discourse these days. Others are pretty unconventional, even fringe. But after losing votes this summer to a far-right anti-immigrant party, the staid-old party of Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher may be taking a page from the GOP playbook and making a tactical shift. Tomorrow we'll learn who its next leader is and how much the party might change under them. Lauren Freyre, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News. This is your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.9 FM in Atchison, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting attorneys Ed Duckers and Pedro Irigonegaray for their program The Counselors, Thursday, November 14th, 6:30 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org.
Hope you'll stay tuned. News headlines coming up at 5:30 in this next half hour. Small claims court was once a place where individuals could get a court solution to a small dispute. Now many cases involve lawyers for big companies going after individuals for small sums. We will also talk about DACA recipients who want to buy subsidized health care plans through Obamacare. They're supposed to be able to start today, but 18 states, including Kansas, suing to stop it. We'll tell you more coming up on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Stoneback Appliance in Lawrence, locally owned for over 50 years, featuring new and used appliances from Maytag, Whirlpool, and more. We've got your back at StonebackAppliance.com.
Join us tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock on your KPR One stations for 105 Live, a new show for KPR. This week, a live session at the Bottleneck in Lawrence, the Draper Family Band. Three generations of musicians, ties to Salina, Lindsborg, and Lawrence. Nick Carswell is your host. Join us for in-studio conversation and live tracks on 105 Live tomorrow at 5 p.m. on KPR One. 65 degrees in Lawrence, it's 520.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt family, a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. While early voting continues in many parts of the country, let's head to Florida. It may not be a key swing state in this presidential election, but voters there are still focused on the contest and on some big ballot measures, like one on abortion. NPR's Ashley Lopez talks to early voters in Florida about their decisions.
For many past election cycles, one of the most closely watched parts of the country was Florida's I-4 corridor. It's politically mixed and stretches from Orlando down to Tampa. Along that stretch is Haines City, which is where Marisol Lopez voted during one of the first days of in-person early voting. She had her mind made up on the presidential election and two big ballot measures in the state.
I just don't want Trump to be president again, honestly. Yeah, pretty much. And, I support abortion and I'm pro-choice and marijuana, pretty much those three things.
Florida currently has a 6-week abortion ban, one of the strictest bans in the country. Lopez says she supports a ballot measure that, if passed, would allow abortions until fetal viability, which is usually around 24 weeks.
I'm terrified. You know, it's never been good when we're, stopped from making choices on our bodies. And I have two girls, so that's very important for me.
Christella Bradley in Lake Alford is also in favor of abortion rights and is backing Vice President Harris as well. But she says she doesn't support a proposed amendment legalizing recreational marijuana.
I'm just tired of smelling it. I don't want to smell it when I'm at the grocery store. I don't want to smell it when I'm out anywhere. That was a huge issue for me.
Teresa Ford also voted early in Lake Alfred. She, however, voted for Trump.
I just can't. I think that if it doesn't turn out Trump winning, I think we could be in big trouble as a country.
And while Ford didn't vote for the ballot measure enshrining abortion rights in the state's constitution, she did end up voting for the recreational marijuana measure, even though she has mixed feelings about it. Mostly, she says, she hopes it generates more tax revenue for the state.
Now, I'm a little apprehensive, but I still voted yes because I think it will make a lot of money for hopefully the right reasons.
Ballot measures can be kind of a wild card in elections, not just because some issues cut across party lines. They're also known to make it hard to predict who is going to vote. But in Florida, a lot of voters said their biggest motivation to vote this year was what most voters in the country are focused on, issues like the economy and democracy. Hector Caban in Orlando, who voted for Trump, says the national debt and high prices are his main issues.
I mean, I'm paying more for gas, paying more for definitely food. Insurance obviously is a big deal around here in Florida.
Andrea Grand has bigger picture worries. This voter in Orlando was an independent voter for many years, and this year he's backing Harris.
I look at the values this country has to offer, and
the values would be one of them, as I said, is to respect the Constitution.
Legrand, who is Haitian, says he also hasn't liked how Trump has talked about immigrants, including his comments about a Haitian community in Ohio. He says he also made his decision by thinking about which candidate would best represent this country's values in the long term. And while Trump is largely expected to win the presidential race in Florida, the fate of the state's ballot measures may be tougher to predict. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Meanwhile, the world is watching the U.S. election, maybe nowhere more so than in Ukraine, where the outcome is seen as a matter of national survival. Ukraine's president says he refuses to give up territory for a peace deal, no matter who wins on Tuesday. But the view from a coal mining town in eastern Ukraine, where Russian troops are advancing, it's more complicated. NPR's Joanna Kakissis has our story.
The town of Dobropilia is just about 20 miles from the front line. Russian missiles frequently strike here. Mechanic Dmytro Mosin points to a bombed-out dormitory. It's scary, he says, but here we are. He and his neighbors are huddling around outdoor spigots, chatting as they fill containers with drinking water. The Russian invasion cut off the town's main water supply. I bring up the U.S. presidential election, and Volodymyr Maruch, a coal miner, says he's really wound up about it. The candidate who supports us is Kamala Harris, he says. I am hoping Donald Trump is not as stupid as we think he is, this fool in a special relationship with Vladimir Putin. Russian troops already occupy 80% of Donetsk, the coal mining region this town is part of. And those troops are outside another coal hub, the nearby city of Pokrovsk, which is also a key supply center for Ukrainian soldiers. Ihor Kurdia is Dobropilia's deputy mayor. He says a third of his town's residents are refugees from Pokrovsk and other besieged cities. But no one is safe from Russian missiles. Just a few days ago, he says, one missile killed a four-year-old girl here. Kurdia is a former high school history teacher. He knows everyone in town. He waves at a kindergartner and his parents as we walk through a largely deserted playground. I worry about our people, he says. I want to save their lives. I want this war to end so mothers do not cry in Kyiv or even in Moscow. He also wants Ukraine to get its land back, and he believes Americans, regardless of their politics, support Ukraine's victory. When there's a new U.S. president, he says, I don't believe we will lose American friends. At a cafe called Sunrise, owner Tatiana Rejeda is less optimistic. She worries the U.S. has lost interest in Ukraine. I hope whoever becomes the next American president, she says, can at least get us to the negotiating table. At her cafe, she says she often hears women sobbing because their sons and husbands have died on the front line. She'd rather save lives instead of territory. I doubt we will return to our pre-war border, she says. We have to be realistic.
Stop, stop, stop. Одну минуту.
Outside the town's hospital, medic Ilya Poltatsev helps a young pregnant woman who is blacked out. He evacuates Ukrainians from nearby towns captured by Russian troops, and he has a plea for the American presidential candidates. If you have a magic pill that will end this war, he says, we are willing to buy it from you. He says it feels like Ukraine is losing allies and might not survive. He's even willing to make a desperate offer to Vladimir Putin. Even if I have to kneel and beg for the bloodshed to stop, he says, I will do it. I will give up everything I own. Depending on who wins this Tuesday, he says, he hopes Ukraine won't have to do the same. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Dobropilia, Ukraine.
This is NPR News.
The new movie Here covers centuries of stories without moving the camera.
Whenever you're trying something different, there's always a fear element that it isn't going to work.
And there is five or six other scenarios of completely different characters at different times.
Exactly.
That are wrestling with that same thematic crisis of life.
Tom Hanks and director Bob Zemeckis reunite. Saturday and Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 7 o'clock on your KPR station, 7 to 10 a.m. It's Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon and Kay McIntyre.
This month's KPR Community Spotlight's on Americana Music Academy, offering lessons, workshops, and concerts featuring the music America plays, including folk, jazz, classical, and more. Details at AmericanaMusicAcademy.org.
News headlines coming up next. Lows tonight in the mid-40s, rain tomorrow in all likelihood, with highs in the lower 60s. It's 5:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Biden administration hopes to allow DACA recipients to buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act.
But 18 states are suing to stop that.
This issue is not about a lack of availability. It is a lack of accessibility.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. As we head into the final weekend before Election Day, both presidential campaigns are trying to convince undecided voters in battleground states. Republican nominee Donald Trump in Michigan blasting former Representative Liz Cheney as a war hawk who's never served in military, saying she should have rifles shooting at her to see how she feels about sending troops to fight. Cheney is a staunch Republican who's been campaigning for Vice President Kamala Harris. Here's Harris responding on the tarmac in Wisconsin today.
His enemies list has grown longer, his rhetoric has grown more extreme, and he is even less focused than before on the needs and the concerns and the challenges facing the American people.
The former president's allies have blamed anti-Trump rhetoric for encouraging two assassination attempts over the summer. Open enrollment starts today on healthcare.gov, otherwise known as Obamacare. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin tells us 21 million people have already enrolled.
This year, premiums are $10 or less per month for many people, and there are lots of plans to choose from. That's a big turnaround from the early years of healthcare.gov when there were few and expensive plans. As enrollment in the Affordable Care Act marketplaces has set new records during the Biden administration, the number of uninsured Americans has dropped dramatically. Secretary of Health and Human Services Javier Becerra tells NPR that after this year's open enrollment,
I have no doubt that we'll see another record set of Americans who have health care coverage.
Open enrollment runs from November 1st until at least January 15th for everywhere except Idaho, where enrollment starts and ends earlier. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
Employers added fewer jobs last month as hurricanes and strikes sharply reduced payrolls. You're listening to NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Kansas tax collections came in below estimates in October, Emily Yonker reports.
Kansas tax collections were about 3.4%, or $23.4 million, lower than state estimates. It's driven largely by corporate income tax collections, which came in nearly 37% below estimates. Total tax revenue is down 2.5% from this time last year. October marks the first month since May that Kansas tax collections were below the forecast. Overall, the state retains a healthy surplus, but the budget forecast for the rest of the fiscal year will be updated later this month. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Emily Yonker.
Four Kansas communities have secured more than $1.9 million in infrastructure funding to improve their local airports. Hutchinson, Independence, Elkhart, and Coffee County will share in the funding from the bipartisan infrastructure law. These airports will also receive nearly $200,000 in matching funds from the state. Governor Laura Kelly announced the news today, saying that Kansas airports play a vital role in connecting businesses to more opportunities and help strengthen local economies. An animal shelter in northeast Kansas is closed and under quarantine due to a highly contagious virus. KSNT reports that the animal shelter in Holton entered quarantine after a puppy was found to have a dangerous virus. The Humane Society in Jackson County says it's closing for 2 weeks because of canine parvovirus. Parvo spreads easily. It has already killed one puppy at the shelter. Kansas has a small but steadily growing immigrant population, but a recent survey from the Midwest Newsroom and Emerson College polling reveals almost half of Kansas voters think immigrants have had a negative impact on the state. Kathleen Alonzo is with the voting advocacy group New Frontiers in southwest Kansas. She says she attributes the poll results to harmful messaging about immigrant communities.
Part of it is shocking, but part of it I can also understand, especially because of the rhetoric that we have heard over the last few years about the immigrants.
Approximately 28% of voters said immigrants have had a positive impact on Kansas, while just over a quarter said they were unsure. This is KPR. It's 5:35.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The Biden administration has been backing more enforcement, restrictions, and punishment for people who cross into the U.S. without authorization. This has been in response to shifting views on unlawful immigration. Many of Biden's policies resemble those pushed by former President Donald Trump. That's got immigration rights advocates wondering whether Democrats will ever again focus on proposals like legalizing the millions of unauthorized migrants in the country. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports.
One of the policies that has had the most impact during President Biden's administration severely limits asylum at the U.S. southern border. It's been in effect since June, and it temporarily suspends most asylum claims. The policy is said to have led to a 55% drop in unauthorized crossings.
The effect is devastating for asylum seekers and especially for families with children.
Ilora Mukherjee is the director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. She says tens of thousands of migrants are stranded in Mexico as a result of Biden's asylum ban. Biden used the same rule former President Trump used in 2017 to ban immigration from several majority Muslim countries and in 2018 to suspend the right to petition asylum for migrants crossing the border illegally. Biden's recent actions as president go against what he did on the same day he was inaugurated, where he reversed many of Trump's rules.
The Democratic Party is adopting the same policies and postures that the MAGA Republicans have been advocating for over the last 6 to 8 years.
In a statement to NPR, a White House spokesperson says the Biden administration has, quote, put forward a balanced approach in order to secure our border and make our immigration system more fair and just, end quote. An example, the White House says, is Biden's 2023 humanitarian parole for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, which allows citizens of those countries to legally enter the U.S. after being vetted. The program is being phased out, even though the administration credits it with lowering arrests at the southern border. Bruna Solid, the senior political director of the immigrant youth-led United We Dream Action, hopes a potential Harris presidency could mean more legal pathways for immigrants.
I know it won't be easy because it never is. These things are not easy. Politicians, I've learned through this work, never do anything out of the kindness of their hearts. You know, they do things when they're pushed.
Solid and other advocates say misinformation spread by Trump has seeped into the heads of voters, and Democrats have been left with trying to be seen as tough. Recent surveys from the Pew Research Center show an overwhelming majority of Trump and Harris supporters back improving border security. Nearly 30% of Harris supporters back mass deportations.
The thing is, you're never going to seem tougher on immigration than Donald Trump, who has promised mass detention and deportation of people.
The Harris campaign declined to comment and referred NPR to remarks the vice president made in Arizona last month. There, she called for revamping the immigration system. She vowed more punitive measures for migrants who cross without authorization and called for a pathway to citizenship for, quote, hardworking immigrants who have been here for years, end quote. Solid says that if Harris wins, immigrant rights groups need to push for a different approach on how to deal with migrants and the southern border. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
Small claims courts are supposed to be the so-called people's courts with informal procedures that make it easy to bring your claim. But Jennifer McKim from our partner station GBH News reports that Massachusetts courts are flooded with corporate debt collectors that are pursuing low-income people, and it's a problem nationwide.
I'm standing outside a courthouse north of Boston with Colette Carlino, a single mother fuming about what happened to her on her court date.
I'm in the negative at the end of the month. Like, I live check to check. I do not get help. I have my three kids.
Carlino is being sued over a credit card debt of about $1,000 in charges and fees. She says were racked up by her ex-husband. She sobbed inside as she explained to an attorney for the debt collector that she couldn't afford to pay it back.
I still have to figure out how to make ends meet, and you want me to rob Peter to pay Paul to pay you. And you want me to what? Forfeit my kids' money. Me to forfeit their transportation to their program.
Small claims at other civil courts across the country are inundated by cases like Carlino's. Big companies suing low-income people over relatively small amounts of money. A new report filed by the Massachusetts Trial Court shows companies filed more than 92,000 consumer debt cases last year. Nearly half of them came from three firms that buy old debts from credit card companies at a steep discount. Consumer advocates say these eye-opening numbers provide much-needed tangible evidence of a nationwide problem they are attempting to better understand and to fix.
We've tried to do that in other states as well, and we consistently see that debt collection lawsuits are the most common type of civil court case in the country.
That's Erica Rickard, who directs the Courts and Communities Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. She's looked at cases in small claims and general civil courts across the country. She says these suits can have a long-term impact on people's finances, affecting housing and quality of life.
What we see is not only this high number of debt collection lawsuits around the country, but we also see very consistent things in what happens in them, which is largely people do not participate in the case, and they experience a judgment against them that comes with court-enforced debt collection. So a really high percentage of these cases end in somebody's paychecks or bank account being garnished.
A spokesman for Midland Credit Management, who sued Carlino, declined to give a recorded interview. In an email, Faryar Borhani said filing suit is a last resort. Midland tries to work with debtors and suspends collections for a variety of reasons, he says, including job loss. He argues debt collectors are needed to assure accountability and help debtors improve their credit. Midland and its partner companies make up one of the largest such firms in the country. They also have faced legal complaints from regulators in Massachusetts and D.C. for violating fair debt collection laws.
Okay, folks, so thank you all for your patience as we went through the first call of the list.
During another court hearing in Boston last spring, legal aid attorney Kristen Borzale of Greater Boston Legal Services said when defendants in collection cases show up in court and are represented by attorneys, they usually win.
People don't realize that they have legal rights. They don't realize, like, who the debt collector is and the relationship with the original creditor, and that there's an opportunity for them to still show up, explain their story, and win, even if they may have owed a debt to this original creditor.
But the recent report found the vast majority of defendants facing consumer debt suits lacked an attorney. About half of defendants lost their cases because they didn't show up at all, sometimes confused by who was suing them or because they didn't get notice, advocates say. Borzale works with one of the few programs in the state that provide volunteer lawyers to educate consumers.
It feels like, you know, we're sticking our finger in a dam. There really needs to be a systemic look at the debt collection industry and the small claims legal framework for how it's handled.
In court, Carlina learned from a clerk that she didn't immediately have to pay the debt because of her low income, but it will hang over her head for years. Carlina said she only learned later that she could have fought to dismiss the suit altogether. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer McKim in Boston.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every couple wants their wedding to be beautiful. On Halloween yesterday, many also chose to make their ceremonies beautiful. About a dozen couples got married in a once-booming silver mining town that many believe is haunted out in California's Mojave Desert. KVCR reporter Madison Ament reports.
Calico Ghost Town is nestled in dry, purplish mountains right off the freeway that connects California to Las Vegas. Walking down the bustling and dusty Main Street, the tall wooden and adobe facades of the saloon, general store, and town hall cast long shadows. And then, at least yesterday, makeshift altars dotted the town.
For richer or poor.
Richer or poor.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
Michael Gibson and Susan Fletcher had eloped. They promised till death do us part in town hall, as hundreds of pairs of eyes from turn-of-the-century black-and-white photos looked on.
We like skulls, we like scary movies.
Fletcher says they used to be part of a ghost-hunting team.
We've been paranormal investigators. We both had experiences and stuff like that.
About 10 other couples joined them in saying, yep, wait for it, I boo. In fact, Halloween is the second most popular day, next to Valentine's, to get married in San Bernardino County, where Calico is. So Chris Wilhite, the San Bernardino County clerk, says they decided to open this new venue for the day and give couples a little of what they get if they went one county east into Nevada.
We're close to Vegas, but we bring Vegas to San Bernardino County with the marriages.
Wilhite dressed up as a cowboy to perform ceremonies. Many brides wore black gowns, like the Adams family matriarch Morticia. In fact, the day gave new meaning to having a case of wedding day jitters.
They do say that the church is haunted here, the Lane house is haunted.
That's Melissa Lacey, who grew up nearby and wore a skeleton sweater to marry her fiancé.
I mean, if you have the energetic feels about you, you can just walk in these buildings and feel the energy.
Some say the ghost of Lucy Lane, who ran the general store, sits at her window at night. Others say a teacher hangs around the schoolhouse. While the paranormal draws people to Calico, that's not why it's called a ghost town. Beata Davis runs the San Bernardino County Parks Department that operates Calico.
Once they could no longer draw silver out of the mine, everybody picked up and left all at one time, leaving it empty and a ghost town.
That was in the early 1900s. Nevertheless, Lacey, who brought along some family members to her wedding, hoped a few more would join.
I'm hoping that some family members' spirits come through as well.
Probably one of the only places where wedding crashers are encouraged. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ament at Calico Ghost Town.
Okay, from crashing weddings to crashing through the backcountry. Women who fight fires for the U.S. Forest Service are organizing, hoping to improve the balance between their careers and family life. We'll hear from the Women in Wildland Fire Advisory Council about the things they hope to change so they can stay in the job they love. That's tomorrow on All Things Considered. Make sure to come back for that. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We are in the final stretch of this historic election season. Former President Trump and Vice President Harris are making their last big push before it all comes to a head on November 5th. I'm Scott Detrow. Join us for live special coverage of Election Night 2024 from NPR News. We will bring you the latest as the polls close and the vote totals roll in, with the context and analysis you need to stay informed.
It's actually going to get underway Tuesday night at 6 o'clock before All Things Considered officially ends. So 6 p.m. till whenever, at least 3 a.m. We know that. Probably longer. Join us on your KPR1 stations Tuesday night for NPR's election coverage. From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 90.3 FM in Chanute, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, Healing Smiles, located in downtown Topeka, offering dental services with an emphasis on dentures and implants with all current health and safety protocols. More at drchronister.com.
Stay tuned. Another hour and 11 minutes of All Things Considered still to come. We are going to learn about election fraud in the nation of Georgia. Held parliamentary elections that the opposition are calling fraudulent. Find out the big mistake that was made at the San Francisco Department of Motor Vehicles. And trying to put some of this campaign rhetoric into context, Mara Lassen will tell us all about it coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello. Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Biden administration has plans to allow a new group of Americans to buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. We're talking about DACA recipients, also known as Dreamers, a group of adults who were brought to the U.S. without documentation when they were kids. Many are uninsured as adults, and with the Affordable Care Act's open enrollment kicking off today, some are hoping to buy an affordable insurance policy. Scott Massioni from member station WYPR has more.
There are more than 500,000 DACA recipients living in the United States, and about 100,000 of them don't have insurance. A new federal rule would allow them to go to the ACA marketplaces and shop for a health policy. And like anyone else, depending on their income, they could qualify for federal subsidies to make the insurance more affordable. Dania Casada Torres came to the United States from Mexico when she was 5. Until now, health insurance was never a sure thing.
When I was very young, I had health insurance through my dad's job. But that was very inconsistent, just given the nature of his job. And so sometimes I had it, sometimes I didn't.
After she graduated from Emory University, but before she got into law school, she was unable to get health insurance for a while. She would go to safety net clinics when she had to, and once she delayed getting care for an infection. If a doctor sent her to the lab for expensive tests, she would just skip it.
This issue is not about a lack of availability. It is a lack of accessibility. In simple terms, without this change in the law, I and many others with DACA status, we cannot afford the monthly premiums, the deductibles, the co-pays that all form part of a pretty standard healthcare plan.
But there are already challenges to the plan. Republican attorneys general from 18 states have filed a lawsuit to stop it. Those states say allowing DACA recipients to buy insurance coverage will strain local resources, in part because it will encourage undocumented people to stay in the United States. However, because the lawsuit's ongoing, some DACA recipients could purchase subsidized insurance this November, but then lose coverage later, depending on the federal ruling. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
And this story comes from NPR's partnership with WYPR and KFF Health News.
Now, to good news for a group of fans who've been waiting more than a century for new content. A short story by Dracula author Bram Stoker was discovered by a pharmacist in Dublin. The story first appeared in an Irish newspaper back in 1890. Now it is being independently published. It's called Gibbet Hill. A gibbet is a gallows, for those who may be wondering. And it's a gruesome tale about three children who accost a man on the road. NPR's Megan Lim has the story.
In a way, this story actually starts in 2021, when Brian Cleary woke up suddenly deaf in one ear.
I remember coming home from the hospital when I was told it was permanent and the tinnitus was melting my brain. And it's a dark situation.
It's called sudden sensory neural hearing loss. The condition required him to get a cochlear implant and relearn how to hear. So he turned to music.
I needed to listen to very simple sounds so that my hearing could develop and I could learn to differentiate pitch again and to learn to appreciate music again. I was like a little baby. I was learning to hear, you know, so I figured lullabies might be a good place to start. It's just one simple note at a time from a glockenspiel.
These lullabies became something of a soundtrack to his life, and he would listen to them while pursuing another task that helped him cope, writing. It started with a blog, but then he moved to another longtime goal of his, writing an 18th century historical fiction inspired by a local hero.
I live near where Bram Stoker was born, so I actually pass that house every day. So I have an interest in local history.
He'd go to archives at the National Library of Ireland, playlist in tow, and look up all things Stoker.
I was systematically going through every newspaper report of Bram Stoker as part of my world-building process for my own writing.
One day, he stumbled on a newspaper from 1890.
I spotted an advert for a short story by Bram Stoker called Gibbet Hill, and I went, what the heck? I have never seen that before in my life. And I've read a lot about Stoker. And I started holding my breath because I thought maybe this is lost work from Bram.
So he had to find it.
I go flying back through the editions, back to the 17th of December one, and I race through the pages to the supplement. And sure enough, I'm looking at Gibbet Hill by Bram Stoker, All Rights Reserved.
Tom Lawler is co-director of the Bram Stoker Festival in Dublin. He's one of the people Cleary called up after making the discovery.
When we heard the full details, myself and Maria and Nisha, who's our associate director, got off that Zoom call, immediately called each other, and I think probably swore more times than we ever have collectively on a phone call before, because we immediately thought, this is huge, this is global.
The story made its debut at the festival last week with a reading by Irish actress Eileen Walsh.
A tombstone by the roadside, marking the spot where a century ago a poor seaman trudging on his way from Portsmouth was murdered.
It is rare that you have 200 plus people gathered in a room with pin drop silence for a half an hour at any event. And when Eileen Walsh was reading that story, that's exactly how the room was.
Then the snake twined itself around the child's ankle and began to climb its way up his body, wriggling around and around his leg and thigh and up and up.
Sure, finding something like this is any history nerd's dream, but how does it measure up to his other work?
I could see instantly that this was an important story, an important addition to the Stoker canon.
Paul Murray is a Stoker biographer. He says what's most significant about the finding is the year it was published, 1890. That's the year Stoker started working on Dracula. And Murray says that there are echoes of themes found across Stoker's career, like snakes and evil children. Lawler, the festival's co-director, also had thoughts.
The thing that strikes me the most is just this, is the kind of casual, banal nature of the evil in the story. These three figures, the rationale for their sort of toying with the central character is never really explained.
But regardless of how the work is ultimately viewed, Cleary, who made the discovery, hopes it'll contribute to Stoker's legacy in a different way.
The beautiful part of the story for me is that the funds that are going to come from this are going to be ring-fenced into a fund called the Charlotte Stoker Fund. This fund that's named for Bram's mother, because she was a campaigner for deaf children back in 1863.
And Murray, the Stoker biographer, thinks we may not even know the author's full canon with this discovery. He told me Stoker had lots of stories that were lost to time, and they're just waiting to be unburied. Megan Lim, NPR News.
With only days to go before election night, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are making their final pitches to voters. And in a race that's super close, success will come down to getting out the vote. So, how are the two parties approaching this just days before the election? Find out by listening to the Consider This podcast from the team here at All Things Considered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from San Jose State University, with 100-plus graduate and research programs ranging from AI to wildfire science. Their graduates and their ideas are working to fuel innovation in Silicon Valley and beyond. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
I'm Peter Sagal. If you're worn out by alarming election news, we'll wear you out with news about everything else on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Join us tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on your KPR1 stations for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the weekly NPR news quiz. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, K210CR Atchison 89.9, K258BT Manhattan 99.5, and KansasPublicRadio.org. It is 65 degrees in Lawrence. It is 6 o'clock.
We want to mobilize vets to be visible, to be out, and to help restore a sense of safety to folks.
How military veterans are thinking about and participating in this year's election.
It is Friday, November 1st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. Kelly, tens of thousands of people in the country of Georgia have been protesting election results there this week, accusing the ruling party of fraud.
Do they want to build a European state and to join the European Union, or they want to go back to the post-Soviet swamp where this country belonged 30 years ago?
Also, Massachusetts is going after what's called zombie second mortgages. These are old loans thought to be dead that rise from the grave.
It puts people's homes at risk. So it is scary.
And Hezbollah has a new leader. We'll report after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are holding dueling rallies within miles of one another this evening. Both of the candidates will be in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, as part of a final push for voters in the critical swing state. Earlier today, Harris held a rally in Janesville, Wisconsin, where she spoke to union leaders. Democratic presidential candidate saying her rival, former President Trump, is no fan of labor.
He joked with a billionaire buddy of his about the mass firing of striking workers. And while he was president, he lowered labor standards and made it easier for companies to break labor laws and then get federal contracts.
The reference is to a conversation Tesla CEO Elon Musk and Trump held on X, formerly Twitter, about Musk firing workers at his companies who might want to unionize. U.S. officials say Russia is behind a video falsely claiming a Haitian immigrant voted more than once in the swing state of Georgia. NPR's Shannon Bond reported it's the latest hoax believed to come from a Russian operation putting out staged videos in the final days of voting.
The video shows a man claiming he arrived in the U.S. from Haiti 6 months ago. He says he and others are voting for Vice President Kamala Harris in multiple Georgia counties. But state and federal officials say it's a fake, likely created by Russian propagandists trying to undermine confidence in the election. Officials say Russia is also behind other recent fake videos, including one purporting to show ballots being destroyed in Pennsylvania. The videos have circulated widely on social media, particularly Elon Musk's X. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger has called on platforms to take the Georgia video down. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
U.S. employers created just 12,000 jobs in October. That's well below what economists had been expecting. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports it comes as the last major economic report before Election Day.
Diane Swonk is the chief economist at KPMG. She says the data for October was heavily skewed.
We had a perfect storm that distorted the October employment report. What we saw is everything from Hurricanes Helene and Milton to strikes in the aerospace industry suppressed job gains in the month of October. We saw only 12,000 job gains, which is the weakest number we've had on a monthly basis since December 2020.
The unemployment rate remains steady at 4.1%. Overall, analysts say the nation's economy is strong, with 180,000 jobs created last year alone. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks wound out the session in positive territory today. U.S. financial markets largely shrugging off those weaker-than-expected October jobs numbers. The Dow was up 288 points to 42,052. The Nasdaq rose 144 points. The S&P gained 23 points. This is NPR. The Justice Department has accused the ride-hailing service Lyft of misleading drivers about how much they can earn. NPR's Derek Kerr reports the two parties have now settled the matter.
Lyft has agreed to pay more than $2 million in civil penalties. The payment is part of a settlement with the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. The government had accused Lyft of making false and misleading statements about drivers' potential earnings. The government says Lyft promoted an hourly pay for drivers in its advertisements, but the company did not disclose that that amount was based only on the top 20% of its drivers. Lyft says it agreed to pay the penalty because it, quote, recognizes the importance of transparency. The government says its suit against Lyft is a commitment to ensure gig workers are treated fairly. Dara Kerr, NPR News.
The New York man whose rescued squirrel named Peanut became a social media star is pleading for authorities to return his pet. Mark Longo says in addition to his precious pet Peanut, officers with the State Department of Environmental Conservation also took a raccoon named Fred from his upstate New York home. Longo says he rescued Peanut after the squirrel's mother was hit by a car. Their playful antics turning the tiny squirrel into an internet sensation with hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram. DEC officials say they seized the animals after receiving complaints. They say it is illegal to keep wildlife as pets, citing the possible threat of rabies. Crude oil futures prices edged up slightly on concerns of possible retaliatory action by Iran against Israel. Oil rose 23 cents a barrel to $69.49 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Public Library, offering downloadable e-books, audiobooks, streaming movies, and more, all available with a library card. Card information at lplks.org.
62 degrees on the KU campus in Lawrence, 65 in Manhattan, 64 in Abilene. It is 6:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. One of the bedrocks of American democracy is the role of the U.S. military, which is why it may have stunned the nation to see that some 15% of those federally charged for the January 6th assault on the Capitol had military ties. But for many who served, this is also a time to encourage civic participation and push back on conspiracy theories around elections. We wanted to talk about those efforts. And here to help us are NPR's Odette Youssef and Quill Lawrence. Hello to both of you.
Hey, Elsa.
Hi.
Okay, Quill, I want to start with you because you sat down with a group of vets this week at a Pints and Patriotism event. Am I right? What is that? And tell us more.
Well, I was at a brewery called Tranquility Brewing in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and I was willing to make that sacrifice to go to a brewery where dozens of veterans were getting together to drink beer and chat. And it was convened by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA. And Allison Jaslow is a combat vet. She runs IAVA, and she opened up the discussion.
You know, whether you served in wartime or not, I think people who served in the U.S. military have had to prove over and over again that they put country before themselves. That doesn't mean that they always agree, but they know how to do it. You know, I think can allow veterans to lead by example at a time when America needs us most.
And they pass the mic around. They've done these events in Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And they're civil and they're friendly, though it's very clear there are people in the crowd who are voting for different presidential candidates. Mm. The other group sponsoring the chats is called Democracy First, and it's committed to supporting the electoral process, respectful discourse, and a peaceful transfer of power.
Well, Odette, we saw on January 6th some of the people trying to interrupt the peaceful transfer of power were themselves veterans, right? What are you hearing this election cycle from other veterans trying to counter that activity this time around?
Yeah, I spoke with Christopher Goldsmith, who's a veteran, and who started a group that exposes the activities of extremist groups. They do this by infiltrating them online. It's called the Task Force Butler Institute. And this time, Elsa, they've been scaling up their capacity, training more vets to do that research in the run-up to the election.
We want to be ready for the next January 6th type of event. So what we're doing is helping people understand what threats are on the horizon from extremists and also what threats are on the horizon from politicians who are embracing extremist violence.
And you'll remember, Elsa, that leading up to January 6th, a lot of people that were doing that kind of open source intelligence gathering knew that militia type groups were planning violence because they were planning it openly on social media. And so that's what these vets are looking out for. And Goldsmith is also working with other groups that are planning offline mobilizations of veterans during this cycle.
Wait, offline mobilizations? What does that mean?
Well, so one of the groups doing this is called Common Defense. It's a national progressive grassroots network of veterans. They have been assembling teams to deploy to locations where crises might unfold. You know, these would be unarmed vets training in de-escalation techniques. And for instance, you know, if they're hearing that, say, an angry armed mob of people are gathering at a vote tallying location, they might send a team there. Perry O'Brien is a veteran and co-founder of Common Defense.
We want to mobilize vets to be visible, to be out, and to help restore a sense of safety to folks. Because a thing that we've heard very consistently is like having vets who are, you know, visibly veterans, you know, wearing hats like this and showing up helps people feel more secure.
Hmm. Okay, so you've got veterans who have participated in extremist groups and you've got vets forming teams to counter those extremists. So, Quill, I mean, were you seeing this kind of polarization just in the conversations at that Pints and Patriotism event in Pennsylvania?
In some ways, it was just sort of a typical conversation. My vets are like anyone else, really. They've got a gamut of opinions, and the way they vote more often lines up with their age, race, and their gender than necessarily their veteran status. Mm. But there were a bunch of references to service and to veterans issues, and folks just seem to be glad to be there. We can listen to Patricia Crossley speaking. She's the wife of a veteran and has family who served in recent wars, and she and her husband disagree about how to vote.
We have different political views. We are voting for different people this election. And I said, when we got here, I'm picking a spot next to the door so that I can read. I just want to say thank you because I had no idea what I was expecting.
I mean, she and many others were just very grateful to have this safe space for a civil conversation. And that's what it was. And it was great. But it was kind of striking to me that we're at a point where it is so remarkable and rare that you can find a safe space for a civil conversation.
So true. That is NPR's Quill Lawrence and Odette Youssef. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
As voters here in the U.S. reckon with efforts by Russia to influence our election, spare a thought for Georgia. The country, not the state, it held parliamentary elections this past weekend, elections that the opposition is calling fraudulent. Tens of thousands of Georgians were out in the streets earlier this week protesting the results, and all eyes are on Georgia's powerful neighbor, Russia, which has a robust track record of interfering in, indeed of invading, Georgia. Well, joining us to talk about it is NPR's Moscow correspondent, Charles Maines, who is in Georgia, in the capital, Tbilisi. Hey, Charles.
Hi there.
What are the stakes of this election in Georgia?
You know, something to keep in mind is that the vast majority of Georgians, some 80%, favor joining the European Union. So all parties competing in these elections were formerly for Euro integration. Yet it's the government of the ruling Georgia Dream Party that's implemented a series of, you know, seemingly pro-Russian policies, in particular a controversial foreign agents law that undermined that goal. And the policies not only put the country's once promising EU accession talks on hold, they raised the stakes of the vote, says Kornelia Kakacha of the Georgian Institute of Politics.
Basically, Georgians have to decide where they want to see their country. Do they want to build a European state and to join eventually European Union, or they want to go back to the post-Soviet swamp where this country belonged 30 years ago?
Huh. Okay, so in that view, it's either join Europe or join the post-Soviet swamp. Despite all of that, the ruling party, Georgia Dream, they say they came out ahead.
Yeah, official results showed Georgia Dream with 54% of all votes. Four pro-Western opposition blocs got about 38% collectively. And the result allows Georgia Dream to maintain its hold on power and continue pursuing these policies that it argues promote peace. In fact, that was a central part of this election. If the opposition framed this as a choice between Russia and the West, Georgia Dream said it was between war and peace. So much so that election posters featured pictures of decimated Ukrainian cities side by side with prosperous, peaceful Georgian cities. So it's not such a subtle reminder that Georgia, too, was invaded by Russia in 2008. In fact, Russia currently occupies 20% of Georgia's territory.
Yeah, still all these years later. Okay, now the opposition and the country's president, who's not a member of the ruling party, they are denouncing this election, as we said, saying it's fraudulent. What is their evidence?
I put that question to Irma Povilashvili, who is part of a coalition of Georgian election monitors called My Vote. So she took me through a litany of electoral violations, including vote buying, ballot stuffing, multiple voting, in some cases physical intimidation, all of which led her to this conclusion, which we'll hear through an interpreter.
And when we are looking at the results that were published on the election day, we can say that they do not reflect the will of the Georgian people.
Do not reflect the will of the people, a serious charge. Okay, so how does the ruling party, which again is the official winner, at least according to the Electoral Commission, how do they respond to that, Charles?
You know, Georgia Dream says it won fair and square based on policy and economic successes. They also don't deny some problems with the vote. They just argue it didn't impact the ultimate result.
Mm. Charles, if I can try to sum up the situation, you're telling me we have a contested election, questions about Russian interference, protesters who've been in the streets. For Americans listening, with our own election day now 4 days away, is it fair to wonder if you and Georgia are living right now through what may be in our near future?
I guess we'll find out. I mean, the key here in Georgia may be the reaction from the West. The U.S. and the EU have both called for investigations into voting irregularities, but they stopped short of calling the election illegitimate, at least so far. Meanwhile, opposition parties here have called for another mass rally outside the parliament Monday.
NPR's Charles Maines in Tbilisi, Georgia, for us tonight. Thank you, Charles.
Good to talk with you.
Look, if you refer to San Francisco as San Fran, you might get dirty looks from people from there, including from myself, because it is lame. It is not a nickname that any resident uses. So when that term ended up emblazoned on a handful of residents' driver's licenses recently, well, it caused a bit of commotion.
When I have told San Franciscans about this, they cringe. And one of the people who received a license with San Fran on it, when she told her mother about the situation, her mother immediately advised her to burn the license.
That is California State Senator Scott Wiener, who represents San Francisco. This week, he wrote a letter to the head of the state's Department of Motor Vehicles, which reads, in part, I am requesting that DMV immediately cease and desist any and all uses of San Fran to refer to Tony Bennett's City by the Bay.
Wiener pointed out in his letter that, quote, no self-respecting San Franciscan would ever use the term San Fran.
As in truly never, he continued. Wiener told us there are plenty of other nicknames to choose from.
SF, the city, City by the Bay. Few people are allowed to use Frisco, but not very many people are allowed to use that. And then, of course, best city in the world, because it is the best city in the world.
I would never even use Frisco. We did catch up with the DMV, by the way. They told us, quote, the DMV agrees a no-nonsense San Francisco works best on a driver's license. They say it was a limited issue, which they have now fixed, and they promise that anyone whose license declares they live in San Fran can visit the DMV for a free replacement.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City, lots of other frequencies too, always online. We are streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from KU Spencer Museum of Art, now showing the exhibition Native Fashion, celebrating wearable artworks created by indigenous people historically and today. Details at spencerart.ku.edu.
Stay with us. Coming up, we will get you an update on the floods in Spain that have been so devastating. The death toll continues to rise. Get you an update of news headlines at 6:30, then talking about the big gender gap in this election and learn a bit about the new leader of Hezbollah. All of that coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Noto Arts and Entertainment District of Topeka, presenting a celebration of souls, Day of the Dead in southern Mexico. Exhibit features photography of the Oaxacan Memorial Holiday, opens October 4th. Information at explorenoto.org.
One of the real treats of the holiday season is always KPR's Big Band Christmas, featuring the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra. It almost always sells out. It's a great time. I've been. Saturday, December 14th at Liberty Hall, a whole night of Kansas City swing, Christmas carols, and there is dancing, I hasten to add. Tickets are going fast at the Liberty Hall box office and Ticketmaster.com. All the details are at our website, kansaspublicradio.org. Mostly clear skies this evening, becoming partly cloudy late tonight, lows in the mid-40s. Get ready for some rain. We're going to get a lot of it this weekend. 70% chance of showers tomorrow afternoon, highs in the lower 60s. It's 62 degrees in Lawrence. It is 620.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness. With off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations order food online from a nationwide network of restaurants. With tools designed to help save time and manage food spend, all on one platform. Learn more at EasyCater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Both presidential campaigns are in the Midwest today as they make last-ditch efforts to court the undecided voters who could lift them into the White House. Former President Trump was in Dearborn, Michigan, a predominantly Arab-American city near Detroit. Vice President Harris was in Wisconsin, one of the blue wall states that she needs to win. With just days to go before voting ends, Trump and Harris are tied in both these states, as well as five others that will decide the election. Joining us now to discuss all of this is NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hey, Mara.
Hi, Elsa.
All right, let's start with Trump. Why do you think he chose to be in Dearborn today?
Dearborn has a lot of Arab American communities. You know, he got the mayor of nearby Hamtramck, Michigan, the first Arab American and Muslim mayor of the city to endorse him. And the Arab American community in Michigan has in large part turned against the Biden administration because of Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. Gaza is a giant wedge issue for Republicans to use against Democrats because it splits the Democratic coalition in Michigan. And Donald Trump went to Dearborn today to see if he could widen that gap some more, get more Arab American voters away from Harris. They used to be pretty reliable Democratic voters, but he's telling them, and he told them today, that despite the fact that he's been basically joined at the hip with Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu throughout his first term, his message to them today was, there's going to be peace in the Middle East if I'm elected.
Well, this, of course, follows a week of controversy on the trail, right? Like, Democrats pounced on Trump's remarks about Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, pointing to the violent imagery that Trump invoked while calling Cheney a war hawk. Cheney, of course, has endorsed Harris. Here's what Trump said.
She's a radical war hawk. Let's put her with a rifle standing there with nine barrels shooting at her, okay? Let's see how she feels about it. You know, when the guns are trained on her face.
What do you make of all this, Mara?
Well, let's first say how Liz Cheney responded. After all, she's the one who had Trump describe what sounded a lot like a firing squad. She said on X, quote, "This is how dictators destroy free nations. They threaten those who speak against them with death. We cannot entrust our country and our freedom to a petty, vindictive, cruel, unstable man who wants to be a tyrant." But this is just the latest in a very long line of violent rhetoric from Trump. He said that there should be military tribunals for Obama and Hillary Clinton. He said the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, should be tried for treason. He also said Liz Cheney should be tried for treason. He's talked about using the military against the enemy within, who he's identified as Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi, and others. He's even talked about putting Mark Zuckerberg in prison for life. So this is Donald Trump's modus operandi. But in the closing days, it does seem to have intensified and become an integral part of his closing argument. Harris addressed this when she was in Wisconsin today. Let's take a listen to what she said.
His rhetoric has grown more extreme, and he is even less focused than before on the needs and the concerns and the challenges facing the American people.
So that's her closing argument. He's unhinged. He only cares about his grievances, not your problems.
Well, what do you think? Like, was this some kind of strategy, or is this Trump just speaking off the cuff?
Well, there are two theories on this. There are some Republicans who think he's just being undisciplined. He shouldn't be doing this. Nikki Haley the other day criticized the Madison Square Garden Trump rally for being overly masculine, saying it turns off suburban women. But other Republicans say if you want to get those low propensity voters, white non-college men, off the sidelines, you're going to have to make them pretty angry or pretty scared. Extreme rhetoric can do that, get them off the sidelines. But the problem with that theory, of course, is that other voters hear that rhetoric too, not just his base. And Donald Trump has always motivated people to vote for him and people to vote against him.
Okay. Well, the Democrats had their own controversy, right? Like President Biden's use of the word garbage and how the White House reportedly modified the transcript of his remarks. All of that prompted a backlash as well. How is that affecting the Harris campaign?
Well, it certainly was a distraction from what they wanted people to pay attention to was that comedian at the Madison Square Garden rally saying that Puerto Rico was a pile of garbage. I think the Biden controversy took some attention away from that. But the Harris campaign does believe that the comments of that comedian has hurt him in the Hispanic community, that there's a big backlash. Harris is going to Allentown, Pennsylvania on Monday, which is a majority Latino community, and I am sure she will be talking about this.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson. Thank you so much, Mara.
Thank you.
Let's head overseas now to Spain, where rescue and recovery teams are still working to access locations where they may find more bodies drowned by flash flooding earlier this week. At least 200 people have died around the city of Valencia from what has become Spain's worst natural disaster in recent memory. NPR's Miguel Macias joins us from Seville. Hey, Miguel.
Hi, Marlies.
Hey, what is the latest there?
Still watching closely that terrible death count rise because as of today, there were areas like the town of Alfafar, right outside of Valencia, where help had not been received yet. There are still houses and cars left to examine. Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez reassured citizens yesterday that the government was there for them. Let's hear what he said.
No vamos a dejar solos a los valencianos y a las valencianas. Vamos a estar con vosotros y con vosotras.
Sánchez said that the government will not let citizens of Valencia down. It will deploy all resources available. Today, in fact, the army sent 500 more members from its emergency response unit, and police units are being deployed from other cities to help with public safety. Today was a national holiday in Spain, and we got to see some images of hope. Finally, people in Valencia picked up water, food, and other things that might help and simply walked to the most impacted areas in the outskirts of the city to help.
And do we know what the impact has been? I mean, how extensive this damage might prove to be?
I think we know yet how much damage there is. There are entire towns where homes have been destroyed, infrastructure as big as bridges have been swept away by rivers of brown water. Think about it almost as a tsunami. This wasn't just water accumulating on the streets. You can see videos where a wave of brown water advancing on the streets until they turned into violent rivers. Communications have been drastically disrupted with nearly 50 miles of railway completely destroyed. Long lines of trucks have been stuck on blocked highways, their products sometimes going bad. And of course, there's the emotional toll. People are devastated, sometimes angry at what they see as a lack of a swift response.
Yeah, I mean, it must just be exhausting for people there. Given how severe it sounds like the storm was, Miguel, Are people talking about whether anything could have been done to avoid that awful death toll, the human tragedy here?
Yes, there's actually quite a bit of controversy around the way citizens were alerted on Tuesday. The official agency that oversees weather events, it's called IMET, started to warn citizens as far back as Thursday the 24th. That's 5 days before the storm. IMET also issued warnings, including a red level alert for the area on Tuesday early morning around 7 a.m., but the direct alert, the beeping cell phone loud alert from the regional government of Valencia went out just past 8 p.m. that night. There is testimony showing that by that time, the flooding was up to 2 meters in some areas. This is also rush hour in Spain, so many cars on the road going back home. In other words, the destruction was going to happen regardless, but the tremendous human toll might have been avoided.
That's NPR's Miguel Macias in Seville, Spain. Thanks, Miguel.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
With just days left in the 2024 campaign, former President Donald Trump continues to preemptively hammer the idea that if he doesn't win, it means the election was stolen.
It's the only way we're going to lose because they cheat. They cheat like hell.
Our voting correspondent puts Trump's false claims under the microscope and explains how to tell election fact from fiction. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join Scott Detrow at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon on your KPR stations for Weekend All Things Considered.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
We have news headlines coming up next. Stay tuned. We're with you till 7 o'clock tonight. It's 6:30.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, we'll report on the new face of Hezbollah.
After the group's longtime leader was killed in an Israeli airstrike.
I think Hezbollah knows a political exit is going to be the only way out eventually, and is preparing itself for that scenario.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The government says employers added just 12,000 jobs in October, far fewer than forecasters had projected, as the effects of strikes and hurricanes left many workers temporarily off payrolls. Michael Regan is a senior editor at Bloomberg. He says this report also shows efforts by the Federal Reserve to cool down high consumer prices and inflation are paying off.
It really looks like we're hitting that proverbial soft landing that economists talk about, where the Fed's been able to contain inflation and while not really doing much damage to the job market. You know, that said, the election is next week. Politicians don't usually have a lot of nuance when they talk about the economy. So this report certainly could be a talking point, and already is a talking point on the Republican side.
The Labor Department says the 7-week strike at Boeing and the impacts from Hurricane Helene and Milton distorted the latest jobs report more than expected. Officials in Detroit are adding extra security measures to safeguard poll workers as Election Day approaches. Quinn Kleinfelter of member station WDET reports that Detroit experienced a near riot back in the 2020 vote count.
Amid false rumors of voting fraud 4 years ago, hundreds of supporters of former President Trump began berating workers tabulating ballots, banging on windows, and chanting, "Stop the count." Now, Detroit elections official Daniel Baxter says poll workers are in a hall with no windows, with magnetometers at the doors, and police enforcing a protest zone. And identification credentials are mandatory.
A digitized check-in system, which will contain a maximum number of each group and organization. Once we max out on that number, no one will be allowed entry.
Officials say new early voting in Detroit should leave workers with far fewer ballots to count on election night.
You're listening to NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Kansas tax collections came in below estimates in October. Emily Yonker has this report.
Kansas tax collections were about 3.4%, or $23.4 million, lower than state estimates. It's driven largely by corporate income tax collections, which came in nearly 37% below estimates. Total tax revenue is down 2.5% from this time last year. October marks the first month since May that Kansas tax collections were below the forecast. Overall, the state retains a healthy surplus, but the budget forecast for the rest of the fiscal year will be updated later this month. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Emily Yonker.
Candidates in one of the key contested seats in the Kansas legislature sat down for a debate today on radio station KCUR. Competing to represent State Senate District 10 in Shawnee, incumbent Republican Mike Thompson and Democratic challenger Andrew Mall traded barbs on Medicaid expansion, cannabis legalization, and abortion. Kansas law bars abortions at 22 weeks, but does provide exceptions in cases of rape, incest, or when the mother's life is in danger. Thompson said those exceptions are in conflict with his personal beliefs.
There's a difference between my personal opinion and what we have in the state legally right now.
Mall says he supports Kansas laws that permit abortion access, including those exceptions. An animal shelter in northeast Kansas has been closed and is now under quarantine due to a highly contagious virus. KSNT reports that the animal shelter in Holton entered quarantine after a puppy was found to have a dangerous virus. The Humane Society in Jackson County says it's closing for 2 weeks because of canine parvovirus. Parvo spreads easily. It has already killed one puppy at the shelter. Don't forget, daylight saving time ends on Sunday in the wee small hours of the morning. The days have been getting shorter and shorter since the summer solstice. A whole hour will be shaved off your evenings, but hey, you get it on the front end of the day. Mornings with light. How about that? Mostly clear skies this evening, then partly cloudy, lows in the mid-40s. Tomorrow a 70% chance of rain with a high in the lower 60s. It's 6:35.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Once again this year, Donald Trump is running for the presidency against a woman. The last time that happened, 2016, it helped create a historic divide between men and women at the ballot box. Now that gap is back, and it is not just the candidates' genders driving that. There's abortion, there's campaign strategy, and a host of other factors expanding that divide in this year's election. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben asked voters and pollsters what's going on.
Here's something a Democrat and a Republican can agree on. The gender gap this year could be huge.
Not only is it likely to be historically big, and 2016 it was quite big, but secondly, it's historically pervasive. Every single demographic group right now has a gender gap.
That was Democratic pollster Celinda Lake. And here's Republican pollster Whit Ayers.
This has the potential to be something close to a gender chasm.
In 2016, the gender gap was historically big, with women preferring Clinton and men preferring Trump by sizable margins. In 2020, that gap shrank by half. But this year, polls suggest it could balloon, ending up even bigger than in 2016. There are a lot of reasons for that, but Lake says the main one is obvious.
Abortion is the absolute catalyst for it, and it's really accentuated it because it's really fueled registration.
Abortion is top of mind for Amanda Burns from North Carolina, who is voting for Kamala Harris.
I never anticipated experiencing anything like this as far as, like, rights being walked back for people in this country. It really is terrifying. I'm just terrified.
Burns sees the gender gap manifesting in her own life.
I do have a lot of family where the men do support Trump. I take it personally when you're voting for somebody who is going to put people in power who are going to take my rights away, my daughter's rights away.
In the last few years, the number of women who identify as pro-choice has shot up, according to Gallup. Meanwhile, some men, young men in particular, have become more Republican. John Della Volpe, a pollster at Harvard, has found that young men have shifted by 14 points toward the GOP since 2020. That's not about abortion, says Ayers.
I think it's much more Hulk Hogan, professional wrestling persona of some of Trump's supporters and rallies.
Hulk Hogan, who showed up at both Trump's recent rally at Madison Square Garden and before that, the RNC.
With our leader up there, my hero, that gladiator, we're going to bring America back together.
It's not that young men are in love with Hogan. It's more that Trump has cultivated a macho persona that the ex-pro wrestler fits with nicely. Trump shows up at UFC fights and has also appeared on podcasts hosted by guys like Logan Paul and Theo Vaughn, shows with heavily male audiences. While Josh Austin stood in line for a recent Trump rally in Greensboro, North Carolina, I asked why he thinks there might be a gender gap among younger voters.
If you look at an American man, you would think of somebody more like Trump, somebody stronger, somebody tall, somebody who wants to do nothing but be successful.
Voters' other identities beyond gender complicate all of this. Trump has, for example, been reaching out to Black and Latino men who have historically leaned Democratic. There's also a wide educational gap that intersects with gender. College-educated women are highly supportive of Harris. Non-college men, meanwhile, are among Trump's strongest supporters. To Lake, the Democratic pollster, that makes sense.
Blue-collar men really feel like they are being disrespected. They are losing their advantage. And the politics of resentment and economic grievance is very high with blue-collar men.
Women, meanwhile, have historically been divided by marriage status, with unmarried women voting heavily Democratic. Joe Serrano, an auto technician in Virginia, says he sees a lot of women with liberal politics, and they tend to be single. Meanwhile,
decent women that I personally know, that are more like they want a family, they want to meet a good man, you know, and they have these aspirations of women that are married, those are the ones that are more typically seen entertaining the possibility of voting for Trump.
One other factor this year is simply that a woman is running. Consider how much the gap shrank in 2020 when Trump ran against a man. Now it appears to have grown. At a Michigan Union event this month, Matthew Paris said he sees this.
A lot of people that I know in my age group and older, just some feel like that they're not ready for a woman to run a country.
Even beyond all this, there are countless other unquantifiable influences on the gap. More than 24 women have accused, including two who came out in recent weeks. There's also just the way Trump and his allies sometimes talk about women. Here's investor Grant Cardone attacking Harris at that Madison Square Garden rally.
She's a fake, a fraud, she's a pretender. Her and her pimp handlers will destroy our country.
Given all of that, it could be easy to make this gap all about Trump. But that would be a mistake, Lake cautions.
Younger women have been getting more liberal over time. Younger men have not. Even if we restore abortion, and even if Trump isn't running, we're going to see this phenomenon.
Whatever the exit polls say, then, it won't just tell us something about this year. It could be a sign of things to come. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Hezbollah has a new leader. He replaces Hassan Nasrallah, the longtime head of the Iran-backed militant and political group, who was killed by a massive Israeli airstrike in Lebanon in September. NPR's Arzu Rizvani reports on the new face of Hezbollah.
Naeem Qassem was never really meant to lead Hezbollah, but Israel has killed so much of the group's top brass in recent weeks that he was pretty much the last man standing.
One of the key things about the new leader of Hezbollah is how uninteresting he is.
That's Lena Khatib. She's a fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. She says Qassem lacks the charisma and magnetism Nasrallah had, as well as his religious standing. He wears a white turban, signifying no lineage that can be traced back to the Prophet Muhammad. But the 70-year-old cleric, who was Nasrallah's longtime deputy, does offer a steady and familiar hand at a time of great uncertainty.
Even though he is not considered to be very remarkable, he is respected by Hezbollah's constituents. So in a way, Hezbollah wants to reassure this community by conveying a sense of continuity and a sense of resilience.
سنستمر في تنفيذ خطة الحرب.
In his first televised speech this week as Hezbollah's new leader, Qasem vowed to carry on his predecessor's vision and to keep fighting Israel. As he spoke, Israel carried out a wave of heavy airstrikes in Lebanon's eastern city of Baalbek after tens of thousands of residents fled following evacuation orders by Israel's military. Under Qasem, the war goes on. But his years of political experience suggests there is also a way out with him at the helm.
Hezbollah has not changed course and selected, for example, a primarily military leader, which is, for instance, what Hamas did with their selection of the now assassinated Yahya Sinwar. I think Hezbollah knows a political exit is going to be the only way out eventually, and is preparing itself for that scenario.
With so many of Hezbollah's top leaders now gone, time is not on Naim Qasem's side. Soon after he was announced to be the head of Hezbollah, Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, weighed in with a not-so-subtle threat. He said on Twitter that it would be a, quote, temporary appointment that wouldn't last long. Arezou Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Many Northeast states are counting on offshore wind energy to bring jobs, confront human-driven climate change, and help keep the lights on. Construction is underway on several wind farms off the Atlantic coast. But WBUR's Miriam Wasser reports there's anxiety about how the presidential election will affect the young industry.
It takes all kinds of people to build an offshore wind farm, like ironworker Rachel Jackson.
This is a famous ironworker sound. That's how you know an ironworker is coming, because the wrenches are clacking together.
Jackson's preparing for another stint on the water. She picks up the safety harness she'll bring with her.
Can I feel it? How heavy
is it? This is an empty one.
Oh my God.
But it's different like holding it and putting it on
30 pounds.
Jackson loves the job. It pays well, and she feels like she's working on something important for the planet. But she worries about the future. The Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, says he'll stop the offshore wind industry if he wins.
I do not want him to pull us out of this opportunity because it is work and it could be something that is beneficial to the environment.
Jackson is not the only one concerned about jobs and the environment. Chris Olith directs the Special Initiative on Offshore Wind, an independent think tank that supports the industry. She says there's a lot at stake for offshore wind in this election.
Kamala Harris is a strong proponent of clean energy, you know, versus a candidate who said, quote, on day one, end quote, he will do everything in his power to stop offshore wind.
Harris doesn't have a detailed offshore wind platform, but she's expected to continue President Biden's policies to get thousands of turbines up and running by 2030. If Trump wins, experts say it's unlikely he could stop operating wind farms or those under construction. But he could make things difficult for projects still in the pipeline by slow-walking permits or rescinding important clean energy tax credits. Eric Hines leads the Offshore Wind Energy Graduate Program at Tufts University.
We should all fasten our seatbelts. You know, there will be more drama to come, just as there has been up to date.
Wind developers say they're nervous, but they don't think a second Trump administration would be catastrophic. They point to popular investments in wind manufacturing and shipbuilding, including in conservative states like Louisiana and Texas. Plus, many states in the Northeast need this power. Electricity demand is surging, and offshore wind is probably the only feasible way to meet it without exacerbating climate change.
Offshore wind is vital for us to meet our clean energy and climate goals.
Rebecca Tepper is Massachusetts Energy Secretary. She says even if offshore wind stalls during a second Trump administration, states can still do a lot, like build new transmission lines and plan for future offshore wind projects.
Whether it's Trump or anybody else, we need to keep our eye on the ball and keep trying to move the industry forward in whatever ways that we can.
And the industry is moving forward. From Massachusetts to Virginia, turbines are going up in the water. Wind advocate Amber Hewitt stands on the deck of a boat 15 miles off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. About two dozen turbines poke out of the ocean like little stick figures. It's the Vineyard Wind Project, the country's first large-scale offshore wind farm to start construction.
I feel like we just drove to Europe. Like, this is a really, it's a really
inspiring moment for me to see this many offshore wind turbines in U.S. waters.
Hewitt leads the offshore wind program at the National Wildlife Federation. She says this project shows the industry's momentum.
It's too promising of an opportunity to ever really be stopped in its tracks here.
So while she's anxious about the November election, Hewitt says the outcome won't make or break the young offshore wind industry. For NPR News, I'm Miriam Wasser.
This is All Things Considered.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we bring you the latest on everything from the presidential race to what interest rates are doing. But we also share stories that take us into other people's lives.
You actually played your horn while they were inside your skull.
Absolutely. Doesn't everybody?
Listen for the unexpected with the news weekdays on Morning Edition.
You can hear Morning Edition 5 to 9 a.m. Monday through Friday on your KPR stations. Jay Schaefer is your local host.
Support for KPR comes from the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting former Congressman Luke Messer and Sherry Bustos for their series Congress in the 21st Century, Wednesday, November 13th, 4 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, lots of other frequencies as well, someplace other than Lawrence. Listen online anytime at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from KU Theater, presenting Hook Man, a darkly comic salute to teenage slasher films, reminding everyone that college can be scary. Playing now through November 7th. Tickets at kutheater.com.
Stick around. Still have another 10 minutes or so of All Things Considered. If you're joining us on KPR One stations, up next we have Film Music Friday. Great themes and overtures from classic war movies. Daryl Brogdon is your host for Film Music Friday till 9 o'clock. If you're joining us on KPR2, stay tuned for Snap Judgment, followed by news from the BBC World Service. Partly cloudy skies tonight, lows in the mid-40s. It's 10 minutes before 7.
On a Friday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Maybe you saw kids trick-or-treating last night dressed as zombies. Well, there is another kind of zombie that's much scarier. NPR's investigations team has been looking into what are called zombie second mortgages. These are loans taken out 20 years ago that homeowners thought were dead, but they rise from the grave when companies try to collect or foreclose. Now Massachusetts is going after one of those companies and helping hundreds of homeowners. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
A zombie is pretty scary, and so are these loans when they come back to life. People can lose their homes before they even really know what's going on.
That's exactly right. It puts people's homes at risk. So it is scary.
That's Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell. Her office investigated a company named Franklin Credit Management and found that it was allegedly violating state and federal law by trying to collect money that homeowners didn't actually owe. Before these loans were zombies, they started out as second mortgages that many people got when they bought a house back during the housing bubble. After the crash, many of the loans were basically worthless, and homeowners say they were told that the loans were resolved through loan modifications. But now that home prices have risen so much, some companies are claiming that the loans are still valid, and they're moving to collect.
If you look at zombie second mortgages, the process itself is unfair. You have folks who legitimately believe that they have paid a debt or that it has been done away with. And now you have a random company and random strangers coming back decades later to push them to pay something they haven't received a statement on, they knew nothing about, and are often blindsided.
Now Campbell struck a settlement with Franklin Credit. Franklin declined an interview and in a statement denied the allegations and said it does not admit wrongdoing. But the AG's office says Franklin has agreed to change its business practices if it seeks to collect on mortgages in the state in the future. And it's agreed to stop all efforts to collect on its entire portfolio of mortgages for people in Massachusetts. How many homeowners are being helped here?
Approximately 518 borrowers. which, of course, is sizable.
Still, the settlement involves just one company in just one state. A recent NPR investigation looked across several states and found at least 10,000 zombie second mortgages with foreclosure activity. So there are still a lot of homeowners getting demands to pay these old zombie loans. And some of them have been losing their houses. Andrea Bopp Stark is an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center. She hopes this settlement by the AG in Massachusetts is just the beginning.
I think it's groundbreaking. I think it's really hopeful because it's kind of a roadmap for other states to use, not just against Franklin, but any debt buyer or lender who is engaging in this kind of conduct with zombie second mortgages.
NPR's investigation in the state of Maryland uncovered the names of dozens of companies that were moving to foreclose on homes over these old zombie loans. The Maryland AG's office says it's received complaints about some of those companies. It won't comment on whether or not it's investigating. Both the Maryland and Massachusetts AGs encourage people to contact their offices if they feel debt collectors are trying to collect money that they don't actually owe. Bob Stark would like to see the federal government take more action, specifically the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Rohit Chopra is the director of the bureau. He says he's aware of the problem of these old zombie loans.
Well, it's certainly something that freaks a lot of us out. We don't want to see some of the worst relics of the financial crisis come back to haunt people. And we're often worried that really old debt that may be invalid is being sold and resold and often threatening people when it comes to their financial lives.
Bob Stark says if the Bureau really is concerned about that, it could clarify exactly what the rules are with this old debt. For example, that debt collectors can't charge a mountain of retroactive interest on an old mortgage if a homeowner wasn't even receiving monthly statements for many years. She says that would be crucial to help homeowners fight off these zombie loans and debt collectors. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
An estimated 200,000 people packed into downtown Los Angeles today to celebrate the LA Dodgers' World Series win over the New York Yankees. It's the team's eighth World Series title overall, their first championship parade since 1988. NPR's Kelly McEvers was there.
The parade started at City Hall. L.A. Mayor Karen Bass said she'd be sending a Dodgers jersey to New York City Mayor Eric Adams. But most people didn't see that. Downtown was so packed by that point, the best hope to see anything was to climb a tree. I met the Rodriguez family waiting in a long line for the porta potties. They've been here since 6 a.m.
I've been a Dodger fan since I was born. I got baby pictures, everything. This is my pops right here.
That's Daniel Rodriguez with his dad, Daniel Rodriguez. Younger Daniel's wearing one of those old school bright blue 80s style Dodger satin jackets like manager Tommy Lasorda used to wear.
This is my great-grandpa's jacket.
No way.
Yeah, my great-grandpa's jacket.
From what year?
From, what was it, probably 90-something?
I got it for him in 1997.
Is he still with us?
No, he's not anymore.
Daniel Sr. tells me about his first Dodger game in 1985. He's originally from Guatemala. He says he and his grandpa, the owner of the jacket, walked the whole way to the stadium. His wife, Sandra, says she got into the Dodgers when she was young. With her mom.
As a kid, I remember her listening to the radio. It means a lot. It means a lot.
The family says this parade is extra special. The 2020 season was short because of COVID. The Dodgers won the World Series that year, but there was no parade.
I know we won in 2020. It felt good. I loved it, but we didn't get to do all this, you know?
This parade is about to make its way to us. Sandra says we should get in position.
I got my son-in-law up on the tree.
Okay, cool. Oh, wow.
Come
cool.
With us.
All right, let's do it. We join up with her daughter, Natalie, who just got married. It's her husband who's up in the tree. Natalie says they showed World Series Game 2 at her wedding reception.
We told the DJ, like, when he got there, I was like, okay, like, when the Dodgers win that third out, like, and it doesn't matter what's going on during the wedding, I need you to play I Love L.A. And he did. Everyone was crazy because we're big Dodger fans.
Pretty soon we see the buses come around the corner, double-deckers, with players, owners, coaches, and family waving and throwing flowers. At that point, it's just a wall of yelling.
We love and celebrate, my friend.
it all goes by really fast. And then it's over.
I want to cry. I think for my husband, I know he's been waiting for this forever. My son, my daughter. Yeah, I'm really emotional. This is beautiful.
Kelly McEvers, NPR News, downtown Los Angeles.
Let's go, Dodgers! Happy Friday! You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Organic Valley, a dairy cooperative of small organic family farms that is dedicated to protecting the land and all the plants and animals that live there. Learn more about Organic Valley at ov.coop. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
After a roller coaster summer, the ballots are set, and the countdown to November has begun. Stay with NPR News to get closer to the issues and closer to your vote.
Tune in Tuesday night beginning at 6 p.m. It's before All Things Considered even ends because polls will be closing in the East. Anyway, join us 6 o'clock Tuesday night for NPR's election coverage on your KPR1 stations. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center of JCCC, presenting Hip-Rof, starring Colin Mockery and Asad Mackey, November 3rd, combining hypnosis and improv for a totally unique live comedy experience. Details at jccc.edu/mtc.
Stay tuned. Up next, we have news headlines, then Stardate, then Film Music Friday. Tonight, going to war with the movies. Memorable themes from classic war films, including Patton, Bridge on the River Kwai, Objective Burma.